the Download. From the new film and Inconvenient sequel, Truth to Power, co-directors John Schenck and Bonnie Cohen. Stand-up comedians Natasha Leggero and Moshe Kasher. And from the hit SiriusXM show Sway in the Morning, Sway Calloway. Now, here's your host, a man who couldn't decide which neon necklace and pair of short shorts to wear for Lollapalooza, Justin Kaufman.
I told you, I drove out to Waukegan and I just hopped on the Metro so I could be a part of the swarm that was coming in today. I put on my short shorts, put on my tube top, you know, grabbed a seat. That's how you do. Good evening, everybody. It's a Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. It's a night that has gone. It's kind of been one of these days. It's early August. It's been up and down, a little bit of flux when it comes to the weather. Severe thunderstorm warnings for Grundy County now, the next 45 minutes or so. We'll keep you updated on all the severe weather that's happening tonight. Like I said, the Cubs are in a rain delay. The Lollapalooza getting rained on. It's just a normal August weekend here in Chicago. But we got your back tonight. We got a great show lined up tonight. I'm so excited. Once in a while, it's in a great while, you have these shows that come together where you work on different segments to try and get them in. And then you get the opportunity to get them. It all happens all at once. And tonight is one of those shows. So excited, you know. I guess tonight the big table, we'll start there, is the two directors, John Schenck and Bonnie Cohen, the documentary filmmakers who directed An Inconvenient Sequel, Truth to Power. This is, of course, the sequel to An Inconvenient Truth, follows Al Gore as he leads up to the Paris Accords, the Conference on Climate Change. It's fascinating. It's a really interesting documentary, and it's great to have them in studio. We'll talk with them about what it takes to put something like that together. I know Al Gore gets a lot of the credit and continues to be the face and the star of not only these movies, but the climate change movement. But there's a lot that goes into putting a documentary together and following Al Gore. And I think John and Bonnie do a great job of giving us an inside glimpse to the meetings with high profile personalities and government officials from all around the world. And lead up to a Paris conference that there's a lot on the line, and it unfolds in a very dramatic way, and it's interesting. An Inconvenient Sequel, Truth to Power, out in theaters this weekend. John and Bonnie in studio, co-directors, The Big Table. It's coming up 8 o'clock tonight. At 9 o'clock, we welcome an old friend of mine, Jonathan Honig. Jonathan, of course, known to many as the Capitalist Pig. He's also put together a photo novella called Pit. Photographic portrait of the Chicago trading floor. It's a very interesting project where he took a lot of great photos from the traders here in Chicago over the years, mainly in the 80s, which is awesome to see the mustaches, great mustaches. But truly, what it does is it takes a component and I guess a snippet from a book that was out in the early 20th century. And that book was called, I think it was called A Pit. And it was called A Pit, A Story of Chicago by Frank Norris. And in that book, and you read the essay that's pulled out of this pit that's surrounded by a ton of great photography, it is a story, it's an anti-capitalist story about people who are trying to make money and the ups and downs and the stress and the positives and negatives in the roller coaster ride that is capitalism in 1903. What Jonathan does, and we all know Jonathan as a capitalist pig, he loves capitalism, right? He kind of takes the excerpts about the positive sides of the roller coaster, and that's it. That's the fun. And he says it at the beginning of his book. I'm not criticizing it. It's just he says that there is a portrait of 1903 Chicago trading that is just fascinating, especially for someone like himself who used to be a trader. The Mercantile Exchange. He gets it, and to the words that are written in 1903 play to any decade from the 80s, 90s up to 2015 when they shut it down here. So we'll talk with Jonathan not just about the book, but also about the stock market. It's doing better than it's ever done right now, blowing records over 22,000. So the Dow is. So we'll talk with Jonathan about the economy, the stock market, Wall Street, and his new photo novella Pit. Coming up at 9 o'clock tonight Also tonight, I'm telling you, it's just all night. So excited to have Sway here. I watch Sway. Sway, of course, an executive producer and reporter from MTV News and a longtime radio guy who now hosts a show called Sway in the Morning on Sirius XM. He's performing the show, or he's doing the show, recording it and broadcasting live from the Chop Shop in Wicker Park tomorrow morning, 7 a.m. If you're familiar with Sway, you know his show is very influential. It's at the epicenter of today's hip-hop. All of the stars, from Jay-Z to Future to Chance to everybody, they come through and talk to Sway in New York. And he's going to be bringing it to Chicago because he's here for Lollapalooza, and he's going to talk to us about what it's like to be in that seat, to be at the epicenter of a genre of music that has become the mainstream, the most popular genre of music in 2017. We'll talk with him about what he sees from the youngsters that come through, and what he thinks of Chicago hip-hop as well. That's coming up later in the show. And also, and this is fun, Sloth Rust, great band. Sloth Rust from Brooklyn, now live in L.A. They are at Lollapalooza tomorrow. They got an after party tonight. They're stopping by, Sloth Rust in studio. Kind of an alt-rock band that gets a lot of comparisons to some of the 90s alt-rock bands like Smashing Pumpkins, Nirvana, Pearl Jam, things like that. So it's very interesting to listen to their music, fronted by Leah Welbaum. A lot of great, critically acclaimed stuff coming out of New York and the music blogs about this band, Sloth Rust. And they will be at Lollapalooza this weekend, tomorrow, actually. And like I said, they're at one of the after parties, the myriad after parties in Chicago that are happening starting tonight, and last night, really, and continuing all the way through the weekend. So we'll talk with them. They'll be in studio. And then, of course, coming up after the 7:30 news here, I mean, the show is so jam-packed, like I said. So much great stuff. Stand-up comedians and married couple, Natasha Leggero and Moshe Kasher. I love Moshe Kasher. I've been talking about him all week. I love his stuff. I really like his stand-up. And he was a co-host of Neil Brennan on the Champs, the podcast. We had Neil Brennan on last year talking about that. Moshe Kasher and Natasha Leggero do two sets at the Park West on Sunday, and then they do relationship advice for the last half of the show or the last quarter of the show, in which they bring people up on stage. And because they've been married a year, they are now experts in relationships. So they tell the people what they need to know, and they sort of riff off of relationships. And we'll talk with them about that and their relationship coming up here after the 7:30 news. Lots of stuff. Yes. This is a show. News, weather, and traffic tonight with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman, and this is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. All right, we'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll do the carry out. Stay with us. All right, it's a download here on 720 WGN. Justin Kaufman, let's carry out. Here are today's top stories. The White House continues to have problems with leaks, both classified info and the leaks coming out of the president's mouth. We call that drool. In this case, verbal drool. The classified transcripts of his early conversations with the leaders of Mexico and Australia show Trump interested in perception and politics, trying to convince the Mexican president to stop saying publicly that Mexico wouldn't pay for a wall. Then there's the case of a golf reporter calling out that the president said in mixed company with other golfers that he spent so much time with at his New Jersey golf club, he said that the White House is a dump. Who cares? But that's what he said, right? Trump went to Twitter to deny that, call it fake news, says he loves the White House, greatest house ever. But the reporter doubled down and said not only was it a credible source, but it's a story that's been shared around the golf community. Which begs the question, what kind of other stories are being shared in the golf community? Look at those shoes. You see those shoes he's wearing? But I'll bet you we're going to get the juiciest, sauciest stuff about Donald Trump will be from that golf community. You know it, right? Everyone drinking their Arnold Palmer, hanging out in their chicken, their club sandwich at the club. You know what I heard? I think that's what happens at golf clubs, right? Leaks are one thing. But it always seems to be that the leaks show us that this president just likes to say dumb stuff to people close to him, right? It's weird, but he's like that one friend who just shares too much about your other friend. Joe, I mean, not getting along with his wife. Nobody asked, man. The fallout from the Senate sanctions imposed on Russia continue as the Kremlin and Vladimir Putin are calling the Trump administration ineffective and weak, specifically Donald Trump, the president, which usually would get a rise out of the president, but he's above that. He doesn't stoop to that level, right? He's dignified when it comes to our adversaries and what they say. Now, Rosie O'Donnell, she says that? Oh, boy, bets off. All. Woo! I mean, really, though, Putin is just mad that he backed a candidate that was supposed to give him favorable treatment, and now Congress got in the way. Nothing to see here, folks. Nothing at all. A new survey says that Chicago's tied for the most favorable destination for businesses who hold conventions. Yeah. We tied with Orlando because, well, that's all Orlando does. But this is a big deal because it beats out other competition from Vegas, LA, Phoenix, New York. And I can only assume that we'll be the outright number one once we get that DePaul Arena up and running down by McCormick Place. A chance to have your convention, eat at world-class restaurants, and watch DePaul get trounced by everybody in the Big East. Sold! It's a memorable trip to Chicago in February, right? LaCroix drinkers are sparkling angry at Walgreens, who mistakenly tax a drink as part of their sweetened beverage tax. There is no sweetened anything in LaCroix. It's plain with hints of pamplemousse. How dare you tax our pamplemousse? I mean, people are so outraged that Cook County Board President Tony Preckwell had to go to Twitter to assure people that LaCroix was not part of the tax. Good use of time. Your pamplemousse is fine. Sorry. It's hints of grapefruit, not real grapefruit. Lollapalooza is underway, and if you're keeping score, one musician has already walked off stage. Liam Gallagher, ding, 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 ding. If you had him in the pool, it's probably the odds on that were pretty high. The famed singer from Oasis played about three songs and decided to go stand in line for deep dish pizza or something. I don't know. He gone. Hey, that's what you went to see him for, right? Antics. You got it. In weather, yes, it is Lollapalooza week, so it's raining. Heavy rain coming through, severe weather. We'll keep our eye on it tonight. I just hope all the news crews have enough time to put their weekend packages together about how Lolla ruined Grant Park. Start writing it now. The Partridge just says there's no timetable for the fields to reopen. I'm Justin Kaufman, WGN Radio. They get that obligatory shot through the fence of construction in there. Get one guy's like, it was real muddy. It was so muddy that I got my Denver Nuggets jersey dirty. In sports, after some rain delays, the Cubs got underway only to get jumped on quickly today. Jose Quintana gave up three runs in the first inning. They gave up six earned runs over five. There's the Quintana we know and love from the South Side. Nah, but this is not the South Side. It's the North Side in the World Championship Chicago Cubs. So even though they were down 6-2 at one point, they rallied back to take the lead in the eighth. But then the rains came and the shoddy bullpen work came and the Diamondbacks took the lead back. But wait just a second. Like a punch-drunken Rocky Balboa, the Cubs countered it and they tied it up. The tarps are off after the last rain delay. The ninth inning starts now. Love it. The playoff tour continues tomorrow at Wrigley. The Washington Nationals come to town for a weekend series, an NLDS preview for sure. That's coming up. That's going to be a good show. Bryce Harper just getting walked. Just walk him every time. The Sox have lost 15 of 18 since the All-Star break, and that's games, not players. They head to Boston for a four-game set tonight. They start tonight at Fenway. They'll go against Rick Porcello, who's just terrible. The reigning AL Cy Young winner is 4-14, and he's already given up five runs in three innings. And the Sox are still losing, by the way. That just means that Miguel Gonzalez on the other side is worse. The Red Sox are in first place in the East thanks to Chris Sale and Mookie Betts, Dustin Pedroia, and who else is on this Red Sox team? You know, I haven't really paid attention that much. It's been a while since I've looked. Who's there? Is Dwight Evans? He's still out in right field with that mustache? He's still there? How about Oil Can Boyd? He's still the third starter on the Red Sox? Rich Gedman still trying to catch knuckleballers behind the plate? How about a Tom Brunansky? Is he still coming off the bench? A Tom Brunansky? Great baseball name. Great 80s baseball name. Tom Brunansky. Yoan Moncada back in the lineup tonight. Collective sigh of relief. Bears practice cut short because of lightning. So soft. Hey, the first preseason game is playing tonight too, Sunday Night Football. I don't know who's on. It's the Hall of Fame game, which nobody watches. So, whatever. I think it's probably the Cowboys. Here's a great story. The Miami Dolphins quarterback, Ryan Tannehill, hurt his knee in training camp. Okay, that's not the great part. The great part is that the injury could pave the way for Jay Cutler to get back into the NFL. Different sports sites think it'd be a great fit because the Dolphins coach is Adam Gase, who loved Cutler when he was in Chicago. So they need a new QB not named Kaepernick, so Cutler would be a wise choice. And it fixes my issue of not wanting to hear him in the booth calling Bears games on Fox, which if he does that, I'm out. Fox is not getting my eyeballs. I will watch the game from binoculars in those condo buildings across from Soldier Field before I have to listen to Jay Cutler question Mike Glennon's body language. That's just not, no. So please, for the love of all things football, sign Cutler in Miami. Rant over. Also, what's up with Colin Kaepernick? He still has not signed with any team because he kneeled during the anthem? Is that what, really? I mean, this is kind of ridiculous that he's being blacklisted by NFL teams for a silent protest. Are teams afraid that fans will be outraged and not watch the games? Is it about advertisers? I mean, heck, I'd rather have Kaepernick in the booth than Cutler. Put him up there, right? But, I mean, the hypocrisy of the NFL football league sometimes, right? I mean, they're doing everything they can to keep Ezekiel Elliott and Ben Roethlisberger and others on the field, and they won't hire Kaepernick because he kneeled, right? I find that annoying, but I'm not the only one. The first AP college football rankings are out, and a shock that's certain to upend the collegiate world. Alabama's ranked 1, Ohio State 2. Like always. Actually, 4 Big Ten schools start in the top 10. None of them named Northwestern or Illinois, but wow, it's going to be a competitive year in the Big Ten. And finally tonight, it's time for Lollapalooza. So if you're taking the Metro to and from Chicago, you might want to plan ahead. The trains are going to be packed with tons of teenage underbutt. Yep. Shorter shorts this year, so you may want to bring some Clorox wipes with you for your daily commute. Ugh, gross. That's the carry out for August 3rd, 2017. Hey, in honor of Lollapalooza, we have a Liam Gallagher special on the menu. It's a pizza that we take back to you after 3 slices. You can't have it. All in a British accent, too. All right, coming up, Natasha Leggero and Moshe Kasher, 2 stand-up comedians coming to the Park West on Sunday with their Endless Honeymoon Tour. Love these guys. Comedy Central stars, stage and screen. Coming up, it's a download, 720 WGN. Stay with us. Rob Martier, how are you, my friend?
Doing well. I've got breaking news for you here. Liam Gallagher update. A tweet apologizing.
Oh, wow. He's growing.
Sorry to the people who turned up for the gig in Chicago. Lollapalooza had a difficult gig last night, which effed my voice. I'm gutted, LGX. I'm assuming that means Liam Gallagher and a kiss.
Oh, I thought it was LaGuardia to... Yeah. I was saying where he was going. That's... Wow. All right. Yeah. Well, he's got an excuse at least.
He's got a... sore throat.
I saw someone on Twitter post that there was someone in like the 8th row who had an I Love Noel poster. That's a great... So you probably saw that. He's like, oh, I'm out of here.
Done.
Oh, I'm out of here.
Had enough of you.
You wearing your short shorts tonight? I haven't seen you. I just see the top half.
My shorts?
Yeah, you got short shorts on for Lollapalooza? No.
No. Cargo
tomorrow
pants,
night.
You know.
Tomorrow night.
46. I'm a little overweight. A little cuddly.
You save that for the weekend. You only have one pair.
That's right, yeah. When I'm prancing in the house with the blinds closed.
When you're at the EDM stage at Lollapalooza, and I'm like, Rob? Rob, hey!
That's not me, man.
It's not me, man.
Hey,
don't tell
up?
People I'm here.
I'm digging for my booze.
Welcome back to the download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, coming up on Sunday, the Park West welcomes 2 of my favorite stand-up comedians, Moshe Kasher and Natasha Leggero. The power comedy couple, married in 2015, are on the Endless Honeymoon Tour. That shows a double bill of both stand-up acts, but also both on stage together, doing bits together, giving advice to couples in the audience, which either saves their relationships or ends them. Leggero can be seen on Comedy Central's Another Period and Showtime's Dice, and of course her stand-up specials and work on the Celebrity Roast. Moshe Kasher is a regular on Comedy Central with his show Problematic. His Netflix special is called Moshe Kasher Live in Oakland. He also co-hosted the Champs podcast with Neil Brennan, one of my all-time faves. And he wrote the memoir called Kasher in the Rye, the true tale of a white boy from Oakland who became a drug addict, criminal, mental patient, and then turned 16. Again, they'll be on stage together at the Park West this Sunday, August 6th. And it's my pleasure to welcome Natasha Leggero and Moshe Kasher to The Download tonight. Guys, thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Hey, that was quite an intro.
Yeah, mouthful. We loved it.
The third act of our show, we like to call it live relationship counseling.
There you go.
We've been married now for almost a year and a half, so we feel like that pretty much qualifies us to give advice to any couple. And if we don't save your relationship, at least we'll humiliate you in front of hundreds of strangers with iPhones.
Talk about Chicago. For you, Natasha, it's somewhat of a homecoming. You grew up in Rockford, Illinois. Talk about both of you and your experiences coming through Chicago and your memories with it.
Moshe conveniently got an acting job in L.A., so he has to leave Tuesday when I've got to go back to Rockford to say hi to my family. You know, that's a little upsetting to me.
Well, Natasha's been telling these mythological stories about Rockford our entire relationship. And then it truly is just bad luck or good luck that I got an acting job. It's forcing me to skip the Rockford leg of this tour. I want to see Rockford because, you know, the way Natasha describes it, it was like Cinderella, you know, growing up scrubbing floors.
Well, also, there's not a Rockford leg of the tour. We are just performing in Chicago, but there is a Rockford day trip that I'm taking.
Yeah, there's a performance in Chicago at the Park West, and then Natasha will be doing a three-day performance in Rockford at her mother's house, performing the role of I'm back in Rockford, and I am happy about it.
Talk about this show. Where did this idea come from to tour together, to do the relationship advice? How did this tour come to fruition?
Well, Natasha's show was definitely one of the antecedent jump-off points because...
Oh, my show, Another Period, we would go to Newport, Rhode Island. I think we actually went there twice to kind of research what was happening in the Gilded Age with all these rich families. And we learned about this one family, this couple who they were very rich and they went on a 10-year honeymoon and then came back with like three kids.
They came back with a family and like the father was like dying. So it was that's how long the trip was. So we wanted to push it even further. We want to come back with grandkids, but we're working hard on it. Nothing yet. But the other thing is we're not Gilded Age rich. So we decided right. We'd make it a working honeymoon. So we can make that money.
It's funny because we've had a lot of stand-ups on the show and they talk about the experience of touring to be somewhat isolating and depressing. The idea that, you know, there's a lot of time where you're not on stage, especially the concept of getting up there and having audiences applaud and having this moment. And then you end up having to go back to your hotel room. Talk about what it means to tour together as significant others and be stand-ups that get to do this together.
Every comedian that's worked the road will know the weekend. There are triumphant weekends when you're in an awesome city having a good time. And then there's the classic weekend where the highlight of your day is walking from the Courtyard Marriott across the mall parking lot into the mall where the club is to have lunch at the Panera Bread while staring at your phone. So we have taken the loneliness out of touring by getting married. We're not even really that into one another. We just really wanted somebody to tour with.
No, but also it's like you'll be staying in these hotels sometimes by a freeway and you can see the Starbucks, but you can't get there. Like, you know, you're like three medians away from getting a coffee and it's just, and then, you know, it's 3 to 4 days as well. So.
Yeah. Now when I was a single comedian on the road, there was some extracurricular activities that I would be able to entertain myself with. And those aren't an option any longer. And so now my extracurricular is staring lovingly at the visage of my loving wife.
What are the keys? I mean, for you guys to be able to have a professional careers where you toured by yourselves, what's the key to going on the road and working so closely together as a couple?
It's important for us that we both kill. We both kill and we get to sleep together that night. But if one of us bombs, then the other one is the one who bombs is never in the mood. So in order to keep the verdant fields of our love life fecund, we have to both slaughter.
But fortunately, that happens every night. So
right. Yeah, right. 100% hit ratio.
Kind of joked about touring single, but do you have to think about different ways to respect each other in terms of what your process is and your preparation and what you do to get into the show to make sure it's not just that you're at least, you know, honoring the work that you've done before you get into your set?
Well, definitely we both have jokes in our repertoire right now that have to do with the perversions of or the kinks of men that get sexual gratification by staring at women's feet. And both of those are a reaction to Natasha's Instagram feed. Now they're constantly commenting on her feet. So depending on
and by the way, I don't post pictures of my feet. They'll like zoom in on a picture of me and I might happen to be like wearing sandals.
And then it'll make it onto a blog that's like legerofeet.org.
It's not like I'm flaunting my feet.
Yeah, she's not doing this on purpose. She's not teasing you fellas. She just has feet. So we both responded in
which I understand is very tempting to all the men out there. You know, women do have feet and we should be somewhat ashamed.
Yeah, no, I think you should embrace those feet. But so we both have jokes in our act. So depending on who goes first, what night is kind of a, are you going to do the foot thing? Okay, I'll do the foot thing. They're different jokes, but they're around the same thing. That is kind of an interesting reality of living with a comedian is that once in a while you make the same observation because they've happened to both of you. In one instance, it happened to Natasha to herself, and in the inverse, it happened to my wife. So I have an angle on that, which is like, creepy dude commenting on my wife's perfect, supple, sexually tempting toes.
For both of you, are you complimenting each other and working together to help each other with your material? Because you both have had careers on your own that have been great. And what's great is that they're a little different styles. So do you find yourselves helping each other and working the material through as a couple?
I mean, I think we inspire each other. Like, sometimes if I have to follow Moshe, it can be really hard because he's such a strong, he likes to close really strong. He's a, you know, he's a very high-energy performer, and I'm a little more low-energy. So, you know, sometimes I have to bring it a little more.
But I think that actually makes the show even better because we're such different. Stylistically, we're so different. And then she does a set, and I do a set, and then we come back together for the third act of the show, which is where we bring couples on stage and kind of troubleshoot their relationship. And so her style is very laid back and she's kind of the mistress of ceremonies. And I'm kind of just this devilish character that's making fun of the couples. And so I think it really complements itself well.
Right. Also, I've noticed at the end, Moshe just wants to make jokes, but I actually really want to help these people.
Right. I'm looking for a punchline to get and let's go home. And Natasha's like, no, we really have to solve their problems.
But we have solved problems. That's why I want to keep doing it.
Is there a time when the couple is not digging it, that they're like, okay, these bits, I'm embarrassed that I got called out, that kind of thing. I mean, they know what they're getting into coming to the show.
I would say that the 99.999% of the time, it is not the couple that is not into it. It is the one member of the couple that did not demonstratively raise their hand when we asked if they wanted to come on stage. So somebody's getting drug on stage that they're mortifiedly against their will. And the other person is just like super excited and thrilled.
You guys have gone from stand-ups where you observe what's going on around you to observing the body language of the people you bring up on stage. Have you gotten better at knowing who might be the reluctant one or what they don't want to necessarily talk about and being able to mind that?
Yeah, we actually have a breathalyzer test. And whoever fails it is the person that wants to be on stage.
Moshe Kasher and Natasha Leggero join me tonight. They are on stage at Park West on Sunday. They're bringing their Endless Honeymoon Tour to Chicago. You guys both have success and another period. I know that, Moshe, you work on the show as well. But are you looking for projects in the future where the two of you work together that you find yourself continuing to work side by side in projects in Hollywood?
We might just. We might just turn this tour into something special for the future that can be seen in perpetuity. We're working on some things.
But we also have, you know, our own projects. Moshe's got a bunch of things he's doing, and I do too. So, you know, it's just the touring especially, it really helps to be together just to make it more fun. Even if you have Lollapalooza tickets this Sunday, you have to come see our show anyway. No one that good is playing Sunday at 8 o'clock. I already looked at the schedule.
Right now in Chicago, there are tonight, there are a lot of people, a lot of 14-year-olds with very short shorts on. Running around downtown Chicago.
Yeah, all the more reason for you to come on down to the Park West.
I'll be wearing sandals.
There you go. That actually may perk up a couple of people. All right, so how has your act changed since you've been married? A lot of your material, both of you, but Natasha, a lot of your material, I was watching today some old clips, and it was about breakups and relationships and being single. And you even told the New York Times just recently that you feel like you were funnier when you only had $30 in your bank account. How has your act changed since you guys have gotten married?
Well, you know, it's challenging because you don't want to be playing a character that is someone that you no longer are on stage. So it's the comedian's job to grow and change and react to the new environment that they're in. And, you know, and I think a lot of comedians have done that really successfully. I think Sarah Silverman is someone who I see, like, who's always growing. And, you know, it's a challenge, and it takes some time off. You need to take time off sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Because, yeah, I used to talk about, like, I would never have a baby. Having a baby is like a DUI from the universe. And, you know, now I'm trying to get pregnant. So it's like, you know, it's like you have to kind of address it. But, yeah, I'm trying. I think I'm doing a good job of morphing into this new person.
Yeah, and I'm doing a good job of forcing her into morphing into this new person.
That is an interesting point, because you guys are high-profile comedians, so when you do make jokes about your relationship or your wife or anything that might be personal, we know who you're talking about. How do you deal with the fact that your relationship is so high-profile?
We are just very grateful that you think it is high-profile.
It is.
And we'll find out at the Park West how high-profile we truly are, depending on how many people are there.
But, depending on how many people don't go see Blink-182 on Sunday.
But I think that, you know, one of the issues with, you know, people always say, oh, why would you date a comedian? To me, it's kind of like, why not? Why would a non-comedian ever date a comedian? Why would you want your love life laid bare on stage night after night? But for Natasha and I, because we both already speak that language of comedy, anything goes. You know, I told her early in the relationship, whatever you want to say on stage about me, there are no limits to what you can say or how much you can make fun of me, because I'm going to be writing stuff too.
And I keep testing him. I'm like, are you sure I can talk about that? He's like, sure. So that's good.
Natasha Leggero, Moshe Kasher, on stage at the Park West for their Endless Honeymoon Tour. Tickets available. It's on Sunday, August 6th, this coming up Sunday. Natasha, Moshe, thanks so much for taking some time out to talk to us tonight. We appreciate it.
Our pleasure. Thank you for having us.
Bye. Thanks.
Download here on 720 WGN. Good to have Moshe Kasher and Natasha Leggero. I love it. Keep it coming. Interesting idea. You rarely hear of two high, I do think they're high profile comedians getting married and then touring together. I mean, that's got to, I'm not saying that it's just got to be tough in the sense that that's like your whole life. You're together, your work, you know. I mean, I think people have problems when they're in a relationship at an office, a cubicle. Imagine going back to back in sets 45 minutes at a time. But yeah, they'll be at the Park West coming up on Sunday. So, all right, coming up, excited to talk with the directors of the film An Inconvenient Sequel, Truth to Power. This is the follow-up 10-plus years later to An Inconvenient Truth. An Inconvenient Truth, of course, that was really Al Gore's PowerPoint. And now it's turned into following Al Gore as he continues his life's mission to bring awareness and education around the issue of climate change. And so Jonathan Schenck and Bonnie Cohen are the directors. They followed Al Gore in this film, the sequel, where he goes as part of his work to different places in the world to talk not just to world leaders, but how the climate change is affecting different people. And there's some really stunning stuff in this movie. I mean, where you go to different places, and a good example would be Miami Beach. And there's a scene in the movie where they go and talk to the mayor of Miami Beach and some of the city administrators and managers about how, regardless of rainstorms, or any sort of, you know, tropical depression, which just landed in Miami Beach, in Miami, Florida, at the beginning of this week. At all times, there is just a slow, like, inch of water that is on their ocean drive, whatever drive. I'm not familiar with Miami's highway systems, but the local highway that is sort of their lakeshore drive, you know, two-laner, it just constantly has water on it. I mean, it's... You know, it's amazing. And you talk to the city managers, and you talk to the mayor in the film, and they talk about it. They say they have some pumps running and they're trying to stop, but this isn't floodwater. It's the ocean. And so they're trying their best to sort of stop the flow of the ocean.
Yeah, I remember in an Inconvenient Truth, you know, they talked about, you know, if these ice blocks, if the temperature goes up a half a degree, you know, all these things are going to raise the ocean 40 feet, and this is what's going to happen to Florida, and Florida's completely underwater.
Right. Well, he mentions it in the
That was my Al Gore impression.
That was pretty good. Very good. No, I thought I was like, oh my god, is that Al Gore? yeah, I mean, it's a big part of the movie saying that Miami, Florida, Miami Beach is the most threatened city in the world. Because you always see these stories of climate change of these islands in the South Pacific, or you know, somewhere out by Indonesia or Bali, where you're like, yeah, man, that's going to get swallowed up, or even Venice in Italy, where you're like, this stuff is. Water's everywhere. But no, they say that the city that has the most threat is Miami, Florida. And so that's a scary thing to think about. And they just had the depression, and they're catching fish, ocean fish, right now along that ocean drive. And they of course, they were just hit with a huge storm.
Well, cross that place off my list of places I want to retire to.
It's nice down there, but yeah. So anyway, we'll talk about that. And it's political because it's Al Gore. And I'm trying my best to make it a non-political story, because I think that's at the heart of what when we talk about climate change. Already there are texts coming in saying, Al Gore. That's how I read that text. Al Gore. But, it's less about Al Gore, and it's more about what Al Gore is trying to accomplish.
Yeah.
And this movie is about trying to get world leaders to agree that there's an issue, and how are they going to cut back on pollution and other things that are affecting the world. And it's one of those things that you look at the science involved, and they do a good job in the film of trying to take politics out of it, but at the same time showing that there is science to how all this stuff kind of plays out and how it's affecting us. A lot of people will say, well, that's just a rainstorm. It's But the way the ferociousness of the rainstorms that are coming through, mm-hmm. or how the 1 or 2 degree rise in the temperature of the ocean, how that affects the entire ecosystem, they kind of go through that. So it just gives you an idea. And I think the politics comes in, how we're going to move forward, or especially when it comes to money and allocation of resources. There's definitely politics there, and they approach that. But at least we get to a point in our lives as human beings where we say, okay, there definitely is a problem here. How are we going to fix it? You know, that you can have a debate, political debate about how you're going to fix it, but let's not have a political debate of whether or not it's real. Like, that's kind of my thought on it, and I think that that's also what this film kind of moves past. I feel the first one, Inconvenient Truth, was an argument about whether or not it was real, and now you're 10-plus years later, and it's more about how are we going to fix it. And that's a robust argument to have, and there are political forces on either side on how you do that. And I think that there's policies and theories and others that go into that, and I think that that's at the core of a healthy debate on how you deal with something that's affecting not just this country but the planet.
Mm-hmm.
But the argument is done, in my mind at least, that, you know, whether or not it's real.
Yeah, I think that's passed.
So that's coming up. Also coming up tonight in the 9 o'clock hour, we're going to talk about the Chicago trading floor and money, capitalism. We're going to talk about the history of the trading floor here in Chicago. Jonathan Honig on the show. And then a little bit later, talk Lollapalooza. We'll continue our coverage of Lollapalooza. We got a great band coming in. And we also will have Sway on the program. Sway, an influential DJ out of Sirius XM, who's doing his show live in Wicker Park tomorrow morning, which is great. Great for Chicago. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, this weekend, the new film, An Inconvenient Sequel, Truth to Power, hit select theaters in Chicago. It's a follow-up to the groundbreaking documentary, An Inconvenient Truth. That movie, of course, starred former Vice President Al Gore and introduced the mainstream world to the rising threat of climate change.
If you look at the 10 hottest years ever measured, They've all occurred in the last 14 years, and the hottest of all was 2005. The scientific consensus is that we are causing global warming. I am Al Gore. I used to be the next president of the United States of America.
This is really not a political issue so much as a moral issue. Temperature increases are taking place all over the world,
and that's causing stronger storms.
Is it possible that we should prepare against other threats besides terrorists? We have to act together to solve this global crisis. Our ability to live is what is at stake.
An Inconvenient Sequel picks up the story 10-plus years later, and as you can guess, climate change is even more dire. Bigger storms, droughts, and rises in temperatures are the norm now. So what's being done to fight this? Well, this film follows Al Gore as he continues his life mission to educate the world to the man-made threats to our planet. And the documentary chronicles Gore's attempts to bring the world leaders together under one understood principle. We have to make a change. The directors of the film are Bonnie Cohen and John Schenck, and they are in studio with me tonight at the big table. You guys, thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
So let's talk. Why do we need a sequel on this? That Inconvenient Truth came out, and it stunned us. It grabbed our attention. Why do we need to make a follow-up 10-plus years later?
Well, when Bonnie and I got a call from Participant Media, which is this incredible company in California run by Jeff Skoll, his head of documentary, Diane Weirman, called us, and we thought, oh my gosh, how could we possibly follow up that film? It was incredible. It was a lightning rod. It really gave us the language to even have this conversation that we're having right now. But we went to Nashville, and we sat down with Al Gore, and he gave us the 10-hour version of his slideshow, updated. And we learned a ton, not the least of which is that we have this incredible bucket of solutions now that didn't exist 10 years ago. The cost of solar and wind has plummeted to the point where it's cheaper than burning fossil fuels to get electricity in many parts of the world. And then we also really were just taken with Al's passion. He really hasn't missed a beat. The guy is like the Energizer Bunny. And we pitched the idea of doing a behind-the-scenes kind of fly-on-the-wall film, and that's what we did.
Bonnie, what did you know about Inconvenient Truth? Obviously, a huge movie that everybody has seen. Before you got into this project, were you the same style or same thought that, hey, this has been done already?
Well, we knew we had to do something different. You know, that was a seminal film for so many people. I mean, you know, as John said, it was a lightning rod. Everyone saw that film. It may have been the most impactful social issue documentary ever. So, you know, pretty daunting as filmmakers to follow on the heels of that. So we chose to do something pretty different. And we thought that as we conceived of the idea as we were listening to Al Gore talk about all the work that he does, that, you know, wouldn't it be interesting to go behind the scenes with him as he kind of makes the sausage, if you will, and, you know, be in rooms where he's meeting with political leaders, go and see when he meets with survivors of horrible storms, when he trains climate trainees, all of that, going to Greenland to talk to the scientists. You know, we thought that we also had the opportunity, as John said, to bring some optimism to this. You know, this actually, if you can believe it, is a hopeful film. Yes, the climate crisis has gotten a lot worse, but there is so much that is being done already that we can do about it. So we felt like we had to jump in because of that.
A tremendous time to document. Because the lead up to the Paris Accords, when this is happening, there seems to be, you're at this moment where climate change is in the ether. It is what people want to talk about. The world leaders are turning their attention to it. And you have this opportunity to be a fly on the wall as a former vice president gets to talk to prime ministers, to heads of state, to other about the issues that affect countries in a very direct, I thought, very frank way. I really, really enjoyed to watch the dialogue between the vice president and the Indian delegation was very fascinating. How much did you know you were going to get? Is it a classic documentary where you're like, we'll just go for the ride? Or did
it's
you
always
know?
It's a fishing mission.
Yeah.
We, of course, us documentary filmmakers who do observational type shooting, we can never have enough. You know, we're just sort of always asking for more access. Al was incredibly accommodating. He really worked with us to try to get us whatever access we were asking for, and he was very generous with his time. The thing that was amazing to us is, you know, who would have thunk it? But actually solving climate change turns out to be really dramatic. And there's a lot of kind of high tension behind the scenes, you know, where these conversations are going on. When you're talking about countries of the world coming together to try to solve this most complex issue of our time. It's really an emotionally intense thing that goes on. In fact, it kind of feels like a political thriller once it gets to Paris. The thing that's really changed, though, that kind of gets to the heart of your question, is that I think for a long, long time, for those who cared about the environment and wanted to do something positive in this arena, it's felt very difficult to convince people at an emotional level how important it is. It always felt like something far off in the distance that would happen to other people. That's really changed. Everyday people all around the world are noticing that things are weird. The climate is, you know, the weather is odd. Rain bombs, droughts, wildfires, sea level rise to the point where it's coming into our streets in Miami, Florida. So it's become a kind of, you know, what you might call the great social issue of our time, and people want to solve it. And that's partly what you feel in the film, is there's this emotional intensity underlying the scenes there.
Yeah, and I always, it's fascinating to me watching the film, the characters that emerge, because I think in this country we sometimes are fed a stereotype character of another country's leader, that they are the ones that are causing the trouble, and they don't want to necessarily change their country's direction when it comes to climate change. And, well, you know, we do here, Barack Obama does in this country, but everybody else doesn't. But that wasn't necessarily the case. You saw Prime Minister in China or others that were wanted to take leadership roles in recognizing that this was a serious issue, not just for their country, but for the world.
Well, and the truth is that this climate conference falls in a long line of history of other climate conferences that, you know, where we've tried to come together as a group of nations to do the right thing, and it's always failed. This was the first time. It was so significant. Paris was a moment for the world community that where we came together and all said, look, we're going to take this seriously. Maybe the agreement isn't quite enough, but at least it's a landmark agreement that we can all rally around and kind of work towards to start to make the change, which is a signal that everyone's taking it seriously now. So when Donald Trump made the decision to pull out in June of this year, it really was devastating for those of us that were there, certainly for people in the movement who have been working on this for so long. And, you know, so we have to think about other ways to fight.
Did you approach this from, we're curious filmmakers, don't know much about climate change, or was this more a passion play for both of you to say, this is something that's important to us, we know this topic well, and we're going to go with Vice President Al Gore and try to make the best climate change film we can?
You know, it's funny. Us documentary filmmakers are sort of a funny combination of, you know, we're storytellers first, really. We're filmmakers. That's our training. We want to tell dramatic stories that move people. And, you know, we want people to laugh and cry and do all the things that great movies do. On the other hand, we really are resolute about our sticking to the truth of the matter. And we, you know, everything that goes into our film, we want it to be unassailable. We triple check facts and we do things that journalists do as well. The key here is that we had an incredible leading man. You know, you think about Al Gore's life. He's 69 years old now. He was elected to the House of Representatives in the 70s. Mm-hmm. He's been really fighting this issue since then, when he realized that nobody else was taking up the cause in Congress. And so his perspective is really amazing. Of course, he had the tragic defeat in the year 2000, where from his perspective, he had been kind of training all his life for this job. His father was also a senator, and then he lost by one vote in the Supreme Court. And yet, he picked himself up out of the ashes of that and created this whole new career for himself. And in a way, it becomes kind of a metaphor for the climate, for the planet. You know, we are in this really kind of devastating, critical moment right now in our environmental history. We need to act. We need to pick ourselves up out of the ashes of this moment and move towards these solutions. It's the most complex challenge we've faced, but we have to kind of look despair in the face and be hopeful regardless.
Is the main character of this film Vice President Al Gore, or is it climate change?
You know, I think the characters are Al Gore, Mother Earth, and, you know, there's also a whole other character, which is the user-generated video, which is all through the film,
yes,
coming from all kinds of people from around the world who are experiencing the change in the climate. And so, you know, you have a climate activist, you've got Mother Earth who's screaming, you know, with her all of her voice now, and then you've got world citizens who are capturing what's happening to their communities and sending them in. We found so many of them on YouTube, you know, devastation from floods or droughts, etc. You know, there's some incredible images of the streets melting in India, and people are walking through, and people are noticing and recording, and this is something that we have to stand up and take notice of as well.
The directors of An Inconvenient Sequel, Truth to Power, are in studio. Bonnie Cohen and John Shank. An Inconvenient Sequel, Truth to Power, comes out in theaters this weekend. Select theaters here in Chicago and the suburbs. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll continue our conversation here at the big table. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guests, the directors of the film An Inconvenient Sequel, Truth to Power, Bonnie Cohen and John Shank. They're my guests tonight at the big table. We're talking climate change and the film that hits theaters this weekend, both here in Chicago and the suburbs. I really enjoyed the film, and I enjoyed the fact that it wasn't as a hit over the head type documentary. Some of the criticism for An Inconvenient Truth was the idea that we're doomed. And as you mentioned, this was a little bit more hopeful. And I thought, and I want to draw out this the one scene when we talk again about the Indian delegation. The argument that they made about the fact that they want to put coal plants in because they're a developing country and they finally have the resources to do so. And they look to the United States and say, for 150 years, you got to do whatever you wanted. You got to ruin the planet. We want our 150 years to ruin the planet. And there's something about, I don't know, watching it and being a viewer, I'm like, they kind of have a point. There was something about that being able to resonate. It wasn't an ignorant argument that was being made. And that's what I appreciated, too, about the film.
Yeah, you know, Al went to India before the Paris negotiations to try to understand where the Indians were coming from. You know, from the developing world's point of view, and India being one of the largest developing countries in the world, it comes down to the fact that they want to pull their people out of poverty. Who doesn't want to do that? They want to build schools. They want to build factories. They want to give people work. That requires electricity. It requires transportation. It requires all the things that we enjoy in our country.
And for a long time, they didn't have those things.
Absolutely. Right. And so it's sort of when they put it in those terms, it's sort of easy to see the world from their perspective. The thing that Al does a good job at in the film is he's able to, and that's basically what I just said is the argument that's been going on in the UN since the early 90s. You know, look, we're not going to pay for it. We're poor countries. The rich countries say, well, we don't want to pay for it. Why should we help you? What Al does is he's able to take his knowledge of what's going on in the solar and wind and other alternative energy industries, plus his knowledge about banking and financing, and explained to the Indians that this can be a win-win. You can leapfrog these old technologies that, by the way, pollute your air and cause New Delhi and Mumbai to be the most polluted cities in the world. You can put in this new type of energy, bring your people out of poverty, improve your economy, and leapfrog the dirty energy that the United States and other countries have used. And so you see him making that point, and you're right, in the film it gets quite a heated debate because passions run high when it comes to solving these kinds of major problems in the world.
But it's awesome as a viewer just to be able to see that happen, you know, with such powerful people in a room not being guarded necessarily because the camera's on.
Right.
Yeah. How do you do that as documentary filmmakers to be able to capture that? Because I would assume in your line of work that there have been times where you think you're going to get something great and they recognize the camera's on and they go right back to talking points.
I think if you stick around long enough on the fishing mission, things start to bear fruit. You know, I mix my metaphors there, but you know what I mean. You know, we were with Al Gore a lot of the time, and he actually got what we were going for. He understood that if we captured the authenticity of these scenes, that it could go such a long way to bring viewers on board and feel like they were experiencing the truth of the matter. And he really helped us in that case in India, as you describe. You know, those ministers didn't necessarily want to be on camera, but they went along with it, partially because Al Gore is such an important figure in the climate movement. So we really did, the narrative of the film really now is a reflection of where the strongholds were in Al Gore's work during the year 2015, 2016, when we were covering him. You know, some people say, well, why did you spend so much time in Paris? We spent a lot of time in Paris because Al Gore's role developed in Paris into something really meaningful, which even he didn't know what it was going to be going in. So that's the kind of film this is. We went with what the world events gave to us. And I think it's a very good excellent reflection of the kind of work that this man is willing to do on behalf of the planet.
For you to be working on this project in such an important year, 2016, not only the Paris Accords, but also the 2016 election and a Republican primary, which you reference, and even Donald Trump and others, but just essentially railing against. I mean, there's a line that that at time candidate Donald Trump says, I wish the president would come back from Paris, doesn't need to be there. He's got other things that are more important, like fighting ISIS. It became a campaign issue in the way that we shouldn't be wasting our time with trying to come together on climate change. So the idea of being a part of not only what was happening in Paris, but documenting at the time, it's almost a perfect flashpoint.
The 2016 campaign was playing, I mean, you talk about major characters in the film. I would say the 2016 campaign played kind of a minor role. It's kind of always lurking in the background, and because Al is in his post-political life, but he's still a consumer of the news, so it's always on the television.
And
so
they want it. Every interview that you guys are in, they want to talk about what's happening.
That's
with the
right.
Election.
Everyone wants to know what he thinks of what he thought of the Republican playing field, etc. So it's kind of lurking in the background all the time, and there's this kind of low-level tension that is attached to it because the fear is that, my God, what if one of these candidates actually becomes president? Then we really have a problem with the climate crisis.
The other thing is, you know, aren't we all tired of kind of the way that we hear the noise from cable news now? It's just like it all just kind of feels like the same song that's playing over and over again. You turn on the TV, yeah. It almost doesn't matter what the issue is. It's sort of packaged in this way, and people opinionate about
it. It's easy to be background. Yeah.
Yeah, and the nice thing about the thing that we have the luxury to do with these longer form documentaries is let it sink in. You're not just reporting on Paris in this film. You're actually there. You're in the room. You're watching things happen. And it humanizes it. And so you're able to see how silly Donald Trump's statements are about, you know, Paris not being important and it shouldn't be a priority
when
for the president.
Every world leader in the entire planet is there.
They're not only there, but passions are running high, and you get to know the intricacies of what's being debated there and how important it is for the future of human civilization. Obviously, it's of utmost importance. So when you see Trump say that soundbitey kind of cable news stuff that he does, that the campaign is all about, then it just kind of puts that into perspective, and you're able to kind of just enjoy in this film, you know, kind of a thoughtful approach where you're able to kind of breathe and allow it to wash over you.
The former vice president is a polarizing figure in politics. Mm. Like you said, he lost by one Supreme Court vote to be president of the United States. He's a figurehead for the Democratic Party in this country, always has been, from being vice president under Clinton. And now with this issue is beyond politics, yet because it's a political figure that is really at the forefront, do you run the risk of it being polarizing or political, even though that's not necessarily the outcome?
You do run the risk because of Al Gore's history, certainly, and he, you know, what people think they know about him and who he is and what he stands for. But if we can get people into the theaters to sit down and listen and experience, I think, you know, the Al Gore that you meet in this film is in a post-political life. He's made a decision to, as he talks about in the film, he's a recovering politician.
Right.
And he has committed himself to this new career as a climate activist. And I think no matter where you sit on the political spectrum, his passion is rather contagious. And, you know, the fact that he offers solutions, he's not just banging a drum about how awful it all is and what we've all done to the planet. It's not a paralyzed with fear kind of film, although things are bad. You don't leave the film feeling like there's nothing that you can do. So his offering up of solutions, I think, puts him in a different category in this film.
Why don't we do this? I want to take a break and we'll get tonight's news. I want to come back. We'll continue that conversation because it's very interesting because The Inconvenient Truth, as much as that was shocking and stunning, there were almost parodies of it. You know, the documentaries that came out after the fact that were all about how Al Gore is a liberal liar. And it almost sparked, if you will, the climate change denying movement. But we'll continue this conversation.
Sure.
Bonnie Coe and John Shank, the directors of An Inconvenient Sequel, Truth to Power, picking up where An Inconvenient Truth left off 10-plus years ago. It's in theaters this weekend in the Chicago area. We'll take a quick break for the news. We'll come back. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio with me tonight, the directors of the film, An Inconvenient Sequel, Truth to Power. Bonnie Coe and John Shank are here. The film hits the Chicago theaters this weekend, both here in the suburbs. It really picks up a story that was told by An Inconvenient Truth about 10-plus years ago. And right before the break, we were talking about Al Gore and being a polarizing figure. And you know, it's truth to be told, when you see him in this role, he goes out of his way to avoid that stigma. You know, he's not pushing an agenda. It's climate, climate, climate. When he's asked about politics, he does a good job of like kind of pushing it to the side. Mm-hmm. But again, as we mentioned, John, I mean, right before the break, we're talking there were climate change deniers. The movement came out of Inconvenient Truth. 10-plus years ago, this became almost a rallying cry for people who didn't want to believe in this.
Well, you know, Justin, the fact is that the truth of the matter, the scientific, you know, unassailable truth of climate change, whatever you want to call it, it's the, you know, scientists studying the complex system of our planet and how it's being changed by greenhouse gases that we're polluting the atmosphere with, is a real threat to the fossil fuel companies. And it's not so much that Inconvenient Truth started a denier movement. What happened really is that the fossil fuel companies got really scared about their bottom line. And they took a page, unfortunately, out of the tobacco industry's playbook. You know, the tobacco industry, once it came out, you know, in the middle of last century that tobacco smoke could cause lung cancer and heart disease and kill people, the tobacco industry didn't take that line down. They hired actors to play doctors.
Right.
On TV to say tobacco smoke is not unhealthy, and 100 million people have died because of that. That's what we're in the middle of right now with the climate crisis. We have these companies whose bottom lines are threatened by the simple fact of the climate crisis. And by the way, the solutions to the climate crisis, which are going to lead the world towards sustainable energy. And Al Gore was kind of maybe you could call him the unfortunate figurehead, and he became the punching bag for those deniers. But in our minds, we show some of that in the film. It's actually we show some of these denier voices and just how ludicrous it got, these statements about, you know, about Al Gore being likened to Nazi propaganda films and the like. It's just ridiculous. But, you know, on the flip side, the cool thing about Al now is that you see him, he doesn't care about party anymore. In the film, he goes to Texas where he meets a conservative Republican mayor,
yeah,
who's taken his town of 65,000 people carbon neutral using wind turbines and solar power. It's kind of fun because he goes and they agree about the solutions. They're from opposite sides. This guy's a Trump supporter. Gore was, as you said, a lifelong Democrat. But in a way, it doesn't matter now. This issue should never have been political, and I think we're finally getting to a point where it's coming out of politics and, yeah, and more into the mainstream.
Well, I mean, it is interesting because in this film, I feel it's less about trying to convince people that climate change is real and more telling the story about how the world leaders get together to try and make a change. That's kind of the takeaway. I felt halfway through the film, the real lead-up was to the Paris meetings and how there have been failures before, but we were going to see how this was going to change and how Al Gore kind of played it out. So less about, like, when I think of Inconvenient Truth, that was all eye-opening. And I think since that time, we've seen, as you've mentioned, I mean, cable news, I think I've just a great episode on Vice, others about climate change. Those images of watching the glacier disappear, the images of big storms and they are one after another are flashed in front of our eyes. Do you run the risk of being desensitized where people are like, yeah, I saw that the stuff from the storm in the Philippines. I saw the material. I saw what happened in Miami Beach. I saw it on the news. I saw it on CNN. I don't need to be reminded of it. The Inconvenient Truth was an eye opener of stuff that we never knew. Do you run the risk of people being saw that?
I mean, I think we have such media saturation in our lives at this point that, you know, we think we know and we think we've seen everything. The great value of documentary is that, you know, for 90 minutes, you have to sit in a dark theater and someone is going to tell you a story and they're going to connect dots for you. They're going to connect dots between what's happening in the natural world and what's happening in your world. And, you know, you might think that you've seen the glaciers calving, but I'm not sure that you've seen them with, yeah, Al Gore standing at the foot of them, or that you see the rushing water going out to the ocean. And then the next shot is that where does that water end up? It ends up on the streets of Miami Beach, Florida. There are connections that we as filmmakers can make for the viewer that they may not be able to do by themselves. So you may think you know, you may think that you've seen it before. But that isn't really the case. Plus, I think where we are now, as I was saying earlier, these user-generated videos play such a role in, you know, bringing the emotional experience.
The visuals in the Philippines were tremendous.
Yeah, people from around the world who are having, you know, are having to punch through the ceiling of a hotel so that they can get to high enough ground so that they don't drown in the seawater that's taking over the building. this is stuff that looks like maybe computer graphics might have generated, but in fact, people are recording it on their iPhones and their cell phones. So our job in this film was to take these images, these somewhat awful images, and connect them, for example, to the refugee crisis in Syria, to connect them to, you know, food shortages in Africa, to connect them to Zika virus taking over and moving further north into the United States.
Absolutely, yeah.
These are the kinds of connections that I'm not sure people are making, and we need to understand the climate crisis.
What surprised you guys? Knowing going into it, I mean, you're going to shoot footage of the vice president on the on the actual glacier, you know, or the area. You know that's going to happen. And when you get up there, is it surprising to see the stuff? Is it surprising to see the water situation in Miami Beach? Surprising to see, in some cases, things that you knew you were going into, but when you were there with the cameras?
You know, going,
it's pretty emotional.
Going to Greenland with Al Gore was really an incredibly... It was an incredible emotional roller coaster. First of all, going to Greenland at all, you know, you're going to one of the wonders of the world. It's absolutely gorgeous there with these incredible ice sheets set off against this crystal ocean water that's beneath them. But you're looking at it and you're realizing, wait a minute, there's something wrong here. This is melting fast. There's ice water rivers on top of the ice that didn't exist before with the ferocity that they now exist. And then, of course, we're there with a man who's been trying to stop this his entire life. So there's this human emotional component as well. So many times in this project, be it in Greenland, be it on the streets of Miami, or in the Philippines after in the devastation after the hurricane hit there. You know, these hurricanes travel over oceans that are now much warmer because of global temperature rise, and they're picking up more steam. And like in Sandy in New York or in the Philippines with Haiyan, they hit and just devastate like they've never done before. And so you got to brace yourself for that. The flip side, though, I have to say, we were just as taken aback in a positive way by just how amazing the technology and innovation is going on in the alternative energy world. And if you had asked me, do we have the tools in hand before we had made this film, I would have shrugged my shoulders. I didn't know. But now I have a clear understanding that they exist. Cities are choosing them. By the way, they can save our economy because the fastest growing jobs are now in solar and wind.
Mayors and governors are all standing up around this country and saying, we want that for our city and our state.
And so does it just come down to a really strong lobby for the fossil fuel industry? What's stopping a governor, say, in the state of Illinois or others that haven't made that transition yet from doing so?
Nothing stopping Jerry Brown or in California or Andrew Cuomo in New York. I mean, there's days in California now where up to 70% of the electricity generated is from renewable resources. Hawaii is moving rapidly in that direction. I think, you know, despite the person that we have in the White House, obviously the president is an important person, but despite that, the views that are coming out of the White House, our country is moving fast in the direction of renewables. CEOs of major corporations like Apple and Google are now taking their companies 100% renewable because they know that their customers want that. It's smart, it's green, but also it saves them money in the long run. Right. So we're hoping that people can come to the film and certainly see the danger of where we are in terms of the climate, but also really get it in a very clear way that we have this choice now.
You know, what's so hard about it is that I think the film does a really great job of not being political, you know, and an issue like you just said that shouldn't be. But the real world consequence of politics shows its head in the fact that Donald Trump has removed the U.S. from the Paris Accord, this storyline that we had a better understanding by watching your movie. I mean, watching up to that point, you're like, everybody who watches the film, you're watching these people come together in such an emotional way. In the back of your mind, you know that the United States has already pulled out of this in dramatic political fashion. As filmmakers, as you're putting your film together and you're using that and you spend all that time together, is it a letdown? Is it emotional for you to spend that much time on a project and be able to tell that story to have it end up the way it's ended up?
It was incredibly emotional for us and for Al Gore when Trump pulled out of Paris. You know, he, as you see in the film, you know, Al goes and makes a plea to Donald Trump. He met with him actually a couple of times to talk to him about Paris and actually thought there was potentially a 50-50 chance that he would not pull out. So he was rather shocked and devastated as well when he pulled out of the agreement. The truth is that the way that the agreement is constructed, the reality of actually, quote unquote, pulling the United States out, what it means in real terms, because of the way that the commitments are outlined, you can't actually facilitate that until the first day that the next president is in office in the United States. So it's going to take a very long time. He said it in words, but to actually facilitate it and have real consequences of it, we're years down the line. And in those years, we're going to see more and more mayors and governors and citizens of this country holding to the commitments that we made as a country in Paris.
And that's great. And there's also power in rhetoric. And we saw that a little bit with you're really trying to get the Indian government and delegation to to think about the words that they choose and how they talk about the issues that are in front of them. Do you run the risk, even though you're right, it's a little disingenuous, the idea of pulling out of anything when you really don't have the it's going to take years to do so. But there's a political agenda to that. There's a there's a message being sent. Do you run the risk of undoing work and agreement and this idea that there's this mass understanding of what's happening to us with political rhetoric?
Of course. I mean, you know, the elections, you know, what do they say? There's elections have results and consequences. And it's all the more reason we need to be vigilant. We need to know what the real truth is, both on the danger of the climate side, but also on the solution side. And we all need to take responsibility. You know, since Paris, the amazing thing is one of Al's fears was that after Trump pulled out, is would other countries use this as cover to pull out as well?
Because
there's other countries out there that seem reluctant.
That just
kind of
went along with
But the opposite there happened too. You know, no other country has pulled out, first of all, and many of the countries have doubled down and actually, as if to say, we'll show you, Donald Trump, how much we care about this issue. Partly because they do care about this issue and they do want a better planet for their citizens, but also countries are starting to realize the huge economic gains in this. So, you know, for example, Donald Trump says he wants to bring back coal. Well, guess what? Coal jobs aren't coming back. That's antiquated technology. What is coming is hundreds of thousands of new jobs in solar and wind. And if we can get those factories into Kentucky and West Virginia and the places that used to have coal mines, there's incredible economic upside. So we're hoping that the film can play a role that can be kind of a dose of truth about this topic. And, you know, this happens in our country. We're a country that once had legal slavery. We're a country that once had legal segregation. We're a country in which women didn't vote. All those social issues came to the foreground. Truth was spoken about it time and time again. It seemed impossible. And then ultimately we flipped and we did the right thing. The climate crisis is the social issue of our time. It's affecting everybody on the planet. It's affecting our country. People are waking up. It's become an emotional topic. Al Gore describes it as the great issue of our time. And we're in agreement. We need to get our act together and do the right thing on this.
Do you have a different outlook on this issue after spending this much time on an Inconvenient Sequel?
I mean, John and I have always been pretty, really committed to the environment. We've made other films that have to do with climate change. So, you know, we learned a lot. We discovered so much about the sustainability revolution. And we, you know, if nothing else, we were able to feel more hopeful at a very dark time politically in our country. So we are grateful for that. And we just hope that we can start to move quickly.
The directors of the film, An Inconvenient Sequel, Truth to Power, Bonnie Cohen and John Shank, thank you guys so much for being in studio tonight. We really appreciate it.
Thanks.
Thank you very much.
I can tell you I was fragile. I can tell you I was weak. I can write you out a letter, tell you anything. Seen minutes turn to hours, hours turn to years, and I've seen truth turn to power. If you could see me where I see you, if you could feel me where I feel you, you'd be a leader, you'd be.
Good conversation there. That movie's in theaters this weekend. I guess Stephen Colbert did a great bit with Al Gore late show where he had them different promos for date night. The idea that this would be a different kind of movie. Changing it up to get more people in so they're not just coming to see a documentary. Maybe a love story, something like that. So he had them live do promos. That's a good bit. All right, coming up, Jonathan Honig's going to be here. The capitalist pig who's well known as a not just a manager of a hedge fund, his own hedge fund, but also for his work in business media, television. He's a regular in Fox News. He'll come in and talk about his new project, Pit, photographic portrait of the Chicago trading floor. It's a photo novella. Talk to him about the Chicago trading floor, about this book. It's a fascinating, fascinating book. And I've known Jonathan for years. I actually haven't seen him. It's almost like a reunion. I remember when he was 20, mm-hmm. 21. We're similar in age. And I was producing, and he had his own radio show at Northwestern. I get the WNUR or whatever. And I think it was a financial advice show. And he was trying to break in, and we did segments, and he did some stuff that was on the show where I was working, and it's been a long time, but I see him all the time. I see him usually. It's funny because I'll open up my Twitter feed on the weekends, uh-huh. and like I follow him. And on Saturday morning, it's just boom. It's because of whatever he said to rile people up on whatever Fox News show has got, you know, just feed after feed after feed on him. But that's great. It's great to see that he's had success, and I can't wait to talk to him about his book and also about his career and about Wall Street. I mean, I'm very interested in what is happening with Wall Street. Is this the idea that we're over 22,000 in the Dow? And I don't know much about it, to be honest with you. It's not an area of my expertise. Very curious about it, not unlike the opera.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also curious about Wall Street. But the idea of is this an indicator? What is this an indicator of? It's an indicator that that Wall Street and our financial industry has faith and confidence in the president and the direction that he's taking it, which is what he was elected to do.
Mm-hmm.
Is it independent of the president and what's happening in Washington? Does it have something else to do with – I read an article as I was preparing for this about – it's less about Donald Trump and the White House and more about how the dollar is doing and some of the American companies are doing overseas. In China, places like that. It's an interesting conversation about what it means to be over 22,000 in the Dow. We'll talk about that coming up 9 o'clock. Also, we continue our week-long series focusing on the bands, artists, and personalities that are going to be at the Lollapalooza this weekend, including starting tonight. It's going to be an interesting weekend of all sorts of after parties and everything that's happening downtown. This has been, even with the rainstorm that hit downtown Chicago, it is just, you can tell, downtown, right in front of our studio here, there's more people on the street than usual. A lot of kids coming back and forth, walking. Sloth Rust, the band from Brooklyn, now in L.A., an alt-rock style, almost a throwback to grunge, are on stage tomorrow at the festival. So we'll talk with them coming up tonight. They're also going to be at the Bottom Lounge tonight with the Pretty Reckless. I mean, some unbelievable. I mean, I have to say, I'm not, at 42 years old, I don't feel like I'm that connected in. But when I start in and you know, I want to do due diligence to get to know these stores, and maybe I've never heard of the band, but I know they're at Lollapalooza and we get a chance to talk to them. And I spend the day listening to their music and reading about them. And there are some amazing, amazing bands that are at this festival that are in Chicago this weekend that have just thousands and thousands, millions of people that are following them, kids that are loving their stuff, their records are huge successes, and you, me, and others who are in, you know, might be in their early 40s in Chicago, I just miss it, you know? But it's great to be able to not only see that, but to see the bands we've had on this week, Pete, bands that you brought to my attention. White Reaper, it's a great example of one. Kwaku Collins, who was in Studio 435. Both of those artists, as I start to see the articles that come out this week saying, best bets recommended, things you need to see on stage at Lollapalooza this week, including Sloth Rust, all of them are on it. Everyone who was on the download, you got a chance to hear from them this week. They're all on the must-see lists that are coming out. So we got our finger on the pulse here. And also tonight, Sway, the longtime reporter, executive producer at MTV News, who has a show on Sirius XM, which is also, I mean, at the epicenter of hip hop. So many stars and young artists come on and perform on his show in New York. I mean, that's where all the news comes out of. If there's anything that happens in that genre, and it's usually from Sway's show. He'll say stuff. So we'll talk with him, who's going to be broadcasting his show live in Wicker Park this weekend, tomorrow. Thanks, Rob. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up in the 10 o'clock hour, like I said, we'll continue our coverage of Lollapalooza. The popular DJ Sway will be with us. He's got a live broadcast. He's got his XM Sirius show, Sway in the Morning. He's really at the epicenter of hip-hop. He is doing a live broadcast in Wicker Park tomorrow morning. The New York-based show is here in Chicago because of Lollapalooza, so he wouldn't necessarily announce who's going to be on the show. It's a special guest, but I'm assuming that there will be some big guests that, since they're here in Chicago for Lollapalooza, will be on his program tomorrow, which is broadcasting from 7 to 11 over in Wicker Park. So that's kind of cool. It's a cool concept. And also, we will talk with the band Sloth Rust, which is from Brooklyn, an alt-rock band that is playing Lollapalooza tomorrow. So that's coming up in the 10 o'clock hour tonight. Well, my next guest is a man who's made his career out of money. Managing it, talking about it, trading it. Jonathan Honig is the manager of the Capitalist Pig Hedge Fund. He's a regular contributor to Fox News Channel. The Chicagoan got to start thinking about money at an early age and found himself trading futures at the Chicago Board of Trade. That experience led him to a love affair with the trading floor and his newest project, a photo novella called The Pit. It's a project that features photography from the Chicago trading floor from over the years, but also takes snippets from the classic work of Frank Norris, the 1903 book, The Pit, A Story of Chicago. You can find out all the info at thepitchicago.com. And Jonathan Honig is my guest tonight in studio. Jonathan, good to see you.
I'm so delighted to be with you, Justin. This is such a story of Chicago. And I think of WGN as being just synonymous with Chicago, with this city. And, the Pit, which, as you said, this is based on a 1904 book. It was actually the best-selling book in America in 1904. But even today in Chicago, a lot of people don't remember The Pit, and certainly nationwide, so I was happy to be able to bring it back.
Why? I mean, you do a lot of work, and you could see you on Fox, but also in other places talking about money. You do the hedge fund. What is it about The Pit that stays in your consciousness?
Well, I think, it is drama. I mean, the Pit, and it's so well known to those of us here in Chicago. It's just been part of the scenery for the, well, I guess I should say for the last 164 of the last 167 years. So it's just in the last couple of years that these gladiators of finance, these, men wearing multicolored jackets with their throats gravelly with cigarette smoke and maybe a little bit of schnapps or something from that morning or the night before, coming in and risking their lives and livelihood for their own selfish financial gain. Totally unique to Chicago, totally visual, totally romantic, and never really changed, Justin. I mean, as you mentioned, the original story was written in 1904. I made the book in 2017, and really the essence of trading in Chicago hasn't changed and will never change.
Well,
putting your butt on the line every day.
This is a love story for the Pit. I mean, this really is. And what I found to be fascinating, and you talk about it in the foreword to this book, is that, the book, the Frank Norris book, The Pit, was a love story. It was very descriptive, and it was very eloquent in the way that they talked about what was happening at the time, LaSalle Street, all that kind of stuff. But at the end of the day, it was really an anti-capitalist book. It was a book that kind of disparaged or kind of took on the idea of the Pit and took on the idea of trading and stocks and finance.
Yep.
You chose, though, in this case, to just take out the part the part just about the Pit.
Well, the part that interests me, but you're right. I mean, the perception of and the presentation of the Pit is anything other and of trading is anything other than complimentary. Frank Norris says that trading is worse than liquor, worse than morphine. And even, Justin, as you said, someone who's spent his life doing this, I sometimes have to agree. I mean, even if you've traded one share of stock, we've all felt that thrill of buying a stock, watching it going up, and all of a sudden you have $500 in your pocket. And the story presented in The Pit is about it's a very, again, I think a very Chicago story. It's a well-to-do businessman in Chicago, and he gets started trading, and, you know, just a little bit on the side, but he gets drawn in more and more and makes more and more money, and pretty soon it dominates his whole life. He loses his fortune, he loses his family, and ultimately he loses his life.
I mean, but that is a story that runs part and parcel with training, with the pit. This idea that the lure, the sirens, if you will, to the idea of wealth and money and profit are there, and you get in, not unlike some of the other vices that you were just talking about, gambling or alcohol or others. And yes, there are so many stories of people who get into that game, and then at the end of the day, they're left penniless, or they went too far. They couldn't keep it in balance. So yes, it's a love story to talk about these people, but it's also something that throughout time has had a love-hate affair.
Sure. I mean, and that's a story that is so, again, synonymous with the city. I mean, great fortunes won and lost right down there, that small piece of real estate at the corner of Jackson and LaSalle for, you know, 160, 170 years. The thing that attracted me, and as you mentioned, Justin, it's not just the book I was able to put together with the pitchchicago.com, but these photographs.
Yeah, right.
They're really, I mean, you alluded to them a little bit. I mean, we grew up with them. They were in the Tribune, they were in the Sun-Times as we were growing up. I mean, how would you describe the stock market went up? You show happy traders on the floor of the exchange. How would you describe the stock market went down? Grimacing angry traders. So these men were always used to show the emotional reality of the stock market, and that's why they should make for such vivid accompaniments to these words.
It's amazing to look at those photos, too, because you do see not only just mustaches and hairstyles from the 80s, 70s, and 80s, but there is, you're right, there is this ferocity, this passion that comes out of those photos where you see people who... If anyone is familiar with the traders and the pit, this is live by the seat of your pants or live on the edge kind of vibe. And in these photos that you've collected in the pit, it shows, it plays, it feels.
Yeah, I mean, that's what always drew me to it, isn't a young guy here in Chicago, Justin. I mean, the minute I saw these men walking around with their multicolored jackets and their almost sometimes dazed looks or excited looks, I knew I had to be a part of that. So unbelievable, so visual, and now unfortunately really lost forever. It's just, yeah. I know there's news out of a new trading pit supposedly being opened up in Chicago. We can talk about that if you'd like, but you know, open outcry trading, the masses, thousands and thousands of traders on the floor in Chicago will never exist again, and that's why I was happy to capture in the pit Chicago.
Jonathan Honig is the author of the photo novella of The Pit, and also the manager of the hedge fund Capitalist Pig and a regular contributor in Fox News Channel. He's my guest tonight. We'll talk more. Let's take a break. We'll stay on that story. Lollapalooza right now evacuated down in Grant Park by the Chicago police due to the severe weather that's coming through the area. The only solace, I guess, the only thing to take away is that it's late. The festival wraps up at 10 o'clock, so... But, I mean, these are headliners. Headliners play at 9 o'clock, so a lot of people who came out to see those specific headlining bands are not going to get a chance to see them as the weather will force an evacuation of Grant Park and Lollapalooza. Not sure if they're going to continue it tonight or if that'll cut the festival on its first day short. We'll continue to update that story. Rob Martier has it in studio with me tonight. Jonathan Honig, he's the author of the photo novella, The Pit. You can get the information at thepitchicago.com. It really is... a great look at the Chicago trading floor through photography that was collected throughout the 70s and 80s,
yep.
90s from the Chicago Tribune, and also snippets from the classic book that Frank Norris did, the 1904 book, The Pit, A Story of Chicago. You know, this really is about a bygone era. I mean, this is when we talk about traders and you talk about the multicolored jackets and what it means to Chicago. Yeah, you and I can remember that. And a lot of people listening right now are like, of course, but you don't see that anymore because it shut down in 2015. What did Chicago lose when we lost the trading floor?
If you tried to describe it to, a Gen Y-er now, Justin, they'd say, huh? There was this immense cathedral of, you know, 8,000-9,000 people screaming and yelling. Why didn't you just push a button on the computer? So, I mean, the futures markets have been synonymous with Chicago's success and rise really since the late 1800s. In fact, Chicago's growth can really be traced to the invention of the futures markets with the agriculture. All it came to town and was able to be processed and sold ultimately through the invention of the futures markets. So I think we lost some drama, we lost some color, but that tradition, I think, Justin, continues. I mean, the trading culture that the Pit born is still alive. Now, it exists in these multicolored traders, the jackets. So those people are still out there, but they're sitting in front of their computers now. By not having a floor,
not having it manual, there is a job loss. There are a lot of traders who did not make the transition to a digital world, just because you don't need as many people anymore. I always thought of it as a place for young people like yourself coming out of college to get a chance to get into finance, to get a chance to make money for themselves. Is that available anymore for people?
I think that's really frustrating, is that, you know, the floor offered a way and the Pit offered a way for people from all different lifestyles. Oftentimes, Justin, people from not so great parts of the city, you know, minority communities, to get their foot in the door of finance and oftentimes work up and make quite a bit of money. So there was a egalitarianism or a democracy about the floor, and that, you know, if you could prove yourself, it didn't matter where you were from or what kind of degree you had or what color skin you are, even if you were a male or a female. So, I mean, that changed, and I think you're right. It's harder and harder for young people, especially, to kind of get in the door. And everyone who ultimately became a trader and got into that business started as a lowly clerk on the floor. And so many people who are now successful in the business world, again, started running orders and getting coffee as a clerks on the floor of the Chicago Exchange. It really only happened in this city.
And I was going to say, Jonathan, I mean, a great point to be made is that the people who are making a living and making wealth off of any sort of futures or trading have to understand the business, and they have to understand the lingo, the way that it works, the time that's spent. I mean, I couldn't jump in right now and be like, I want to get into finance.
But you know what? Now it's algorithms. I mean, that's, you know, the ideas presented in the Pit and at thepitchicago.com, that drama is about the human drama. It's about screaming and yelling and seeing your competitor across the Pit and physically moving to get that trade. I mean, that's, I think, what has been lost now. Now it's computers and a server and Secaucus, New Jersey, or whatever, Tallahassee, Florida, buzzing away, processing many more trades, you know, billions and billions of more trades. But that visual, that human entity is lost, and the mentoring element that you allude to lost as well.
Yeah, it is. It's true. I mean, a lot of what's in the book is personal. And you mentioned in the last segment about the idea that a lot of these photos sort of evoke an emotion. And it's been used in the newspapers. And I think the reason that we resonate to those photos is because you're absolutely right. When you open the business section in the Tribune or Sun-Times, those were the photos you saw almost on a daily basis to give you an indicator of where the economy or where Wall Street or future trading was at.
The pendulum of greed and fear, that will never change in markets. And that's what's always been portrayed. And that's what drew me to the project in thepit.com is just demonstrating that.
Yeah, I mean, it is such – you're right. It's a total rush. Greed and fear. And that still moves the market today.
Yeah.
I mean, that's still, even with the computers and the algorithms, and there still is a human emotion attached. Greed and fear.
It's the pendulum that swings back and forth. And, you know, now with the market at all-time highs over and over and over again, now for the better part of, what, 2 or 3 years we've been hitting, now 22,000 on the Dow, a lot of people are starting to say maybe we've swung too far to the greed side. Maybe the market's a little overextended, and I don't know, given the fact the president's now crowing about it, maybe due for a little bit of a tumble.
Yeah, and I want to ask you about that, especially. You know, you mentioned there is a movement to bring the Pits back in Chicago. Today there was this week there was an announcement that someone had filed to bring it back. Is that all show? Is that all novelty at this point? Only for the fact that, like you said, it is human emotion and drama, but most of the trading now is done at the split algorithm of a computer in Tallahassee.
I'm delighted to see anyone investing in this city, given all the roadblocks, I think, that local legislators and the pop tax and the bag tax and every roadblock they put and make it difficult for people to come here and actually invest. So, you know, Justin, yes, there's a development or a proposal, essentially from an exchange called the Box Exchange to open up an options exchange. Open outcry, as you said. My hope is that we'll be big and thriving. My guess is it'll probably be much more modest, but I think that's okay. I think, as long as companies want to come and locate here and hire and start the next generation, you know, it's kind of like, you know, vaudeville. Great memories. We're never going to go back to vaudeville. We can still celebrate it, remember it, and ultimately the golden age of open outcry. That's what it's featured in the pitchchicago.com. That's never coming back.
Jonathan, did we lose something when it comes to our city's financial footing, meaning where we're at in the world when the futures, when it closed up, when the board closed up? Did Chicago lose even some swagger around the world?
Yes and no. I think your point about swagger, Justin, is straight on because, you know, for most of the last 150, 160 years, it was New York that was considered the financial capital of the world. And there was always this rivalry between the Chicago traders and the New York traders. And the New Yorkers were kind of, you know, the waspy kind of blue bloods, you know, from the old money on the East Coast. The Chicago traders, they considered them, you know, the kind of the pit, sweaty pit guys from Chicago. So there was always this quiet rivalry. And ultimately, with the sweaty pit traders, or they used to call them, I guess, pork belly traders in Chicago, becoming tremendously successful. I don't think the swagger's changed now that the floor floor is gone. I just think it's changed. So many of the huge hedge funds, the huge money management funds, are now located here. A lot of those are
really
staffed and populated by folks who used to be and kind of cut their teeth on the floor.
All right, so at least they moved into the area, but there hasn't been too much of a drop-off when it comes to the financial industry here?
No, I mean, Chicago is still, by every stretch of the imagination, the first city of trading, the second city of finance, and I think it's why it's so important that we keep this a livable, affordable place, not only just for people to live, but for companies to do business.
Why is it then, Jonathan, that when I think of trading, and I know, and I'm a Chicagoan, and I love Chicago Board of Trade. I love it, and you're right. I know those feelings, but you know, I have been trained to think Wall Street. I am trained to think the Dow. I'm trained to think that's where, whether it be the, you know, the Wolf of Wall Street or whatever it might be. That's trading. That's where it's at. Chicago was a secondary market,
right? But Chicago always got the blame. Remember that? I mean, in the 1987 crash, they didn't blame Wall Street. They blamed the futures traders in Chicago. Or when crop prices went way down, they didn't blame the financiers in Wall Street. They blamed the speculators in Chicago. So Chicago's always been this tremendous trading town. So you've always been gotten the blame, whether prices are too high. You know, when energy prices went too high, well, it's the speculators in Chicago pushing them up. So, you know,
was that the difference that we were the speculators and
Well, in New York, they do that's investment, blue chips, long. You know, in Chicago, it was always a sense of, these are just wild animals screaming and yelling, buying and selling on the floor, you know, blowing up, cocaine. You know, that was the image of
the image of a Chicago trader.
And during the 80s and 90s, some of it was quite true from my experience.
Was there, well, I mean, yeah, I mean, you were in it. I mean, as a young kid, I mean, were you just, were you struck by that? Were you struck by the idea? I mean, you were in the 90s. But
there was the thing I always remember was there was something called the Merck Club. So the Mercantile Exchange, you know, was this huge. I was there in the mid-1990s. And then there was the Merck Club, which was a bar with a ticker in it. And this was, you know, pre-computer. So it wasn't uncommon for the folks I work with to make a couple trades between 8:45 and 9:30, go down to the Merck Club, you know, tie a couple on, go out, trade for a few more hours. I mean, it was a lifestyle that you just will never see again, and certainly never see it in any kind of major organization like that. So really unusual and something I remember quite vividly.
Jonathan Honig's my guest tonight. He is the man behind the photo novella, the photographic portrait of the Chicago trading floor called The Pit, which takes photography from the Tribune from the 70s, 80s, and 90s, and also snippets from Frank Norris's 1904 book, The Pit, A Story of Chicago. Here's what we'll do. We'll take a break. We'll get the news, and we'll continue our conversation with Jonathan Honig here on The Download. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. Yeah, we're starting to see the first steady stream of people coming out of Lollapalooza, walking up here on Michigan Avenue. That's a good 5 or 6 block walk, right? So by the time they get to here, you can see they're drenched, or they've decided to turn it in for the night after the evacuation of Grant Park because of the storms that were coming through. It looks like it's gone through already. So we'll keep an eye on that here on The Download with Rob, of course, coming up here. In studio with me tonight, Jonathan Honig. He is the author of the photographic portrait of the Chicago trading floor, The Pit. It's a photo novella that is really a combination of photography that was done of the trading floors here in Chicago back in the 70s and 80s, and also some snippets from the classic work of Frank Norris, The Pit, The Story of Chicago, 1904 book. Jonathan, of course, also a Fox News contributor. You're also a hedge fund manager, capitalist pig.
Fabulous dancer.
fabulous dancer. We've known each other for a long time. I was telling the audience before you came in that I think we were both 21 years old, 22, somewhere in that area when we were working together when you were doing Capitalist Pig stuff when you were just starting out.
Yeah,
so.
And you know it's been tremendous, Justin, I have to say, to see your career right here in Chicago. You've established yourselves as really a true Chicago, an authentic true Chicago voice. So we need more and more of them, and your work has reflected that.
And you've established yourself as a guy on Fox News that likes to argue.
Well, there's a lot to argue about, especially when it comes to money and politics. Yeah. These are important things. And when you look at what can happen with the market, when you can look at what can happen certainly with Washington, D.C., these are issues that I think you have to get passionate about.
I thought I was really happy to know you were coming in this week when I saw the news that the Dow went over 22,000. Talk about that. Talk about the idea of record highs, this idea of breaking records on Wall Street. What does that mean? What's that mean? I'm not a finance guy. I don't do a lot of finance coverage. It's not something that's in my blood. But my curiosity when I see it's breaking records.
Well, you know, it's a good thing. I mean, to see the stock market rising, no matter whether you own a share or not, is a positive thing. It means that wealth is being created. It means that trade is getting done. You know, where stock markets don't exist and thrive are countries like North Korea, countries like Cuba. So the fact that it's at an all-time high is a positive thing. Now, what does 22,000 mean, Justin? There's no way to say that's more or less important than 21,500 or even 23,000.
Right, right.
But the fact that the market's been doing well for quite some time, I think just bodes well for the economy writ large. It's what has allowed companies like Amazon or like Facebook to become such a major part of our lives. I mean, is there a day that goes by where we probably don't use two services like that and untold others that have gotten their funding in the stock market? So it's a plus. It's a plus.
Is it an indicator of Wall Street's confidence in the White House, in Donald Trump? I mean, Donald Trump will go on Twitter and he'll go in front of rallies and say, the economy is rebounding because of me, there's a lot to that. And I guess I would say that if it was President Obama, he'd be saying the same thing. I mean,
Trump also said that the market was a huge bubble that was going to burst a year and a half ago when he was running. It was a huge bubble. Now it's at all-time highs because of all of the positive.
But how much of it is the confidence Wall Street has in a President Trump?
I think it's the confidence in, frankly, people like Jeff Bezos. People who head these major companies that are changing our lives for the better. You know, politics matters, I think, but it's not the only thing that drives the markets. And certainly, I mean, what drives it is the innovation. Are the companies like Apple? I mean, Apple just released earnings this week that beat expectations.
Wow.
The new phone is going to recognize your face and cost $1,200. I mean, it sounds like a lot of money, but Justin, think when we were young, the encyclopedia cost $1,200. And, you know, that was in $1980 or $1995.
Right, right.
So as long as we continue to have these innovative companies, I think it's probably not unlike the late 1990s. A lot of tumult in Washington with Bill Clinton, but the market did quite well because of the first generation of internet stocks. You're seeing the same thing now.
Yeah, that's interesting because there is, I mean, not just here in the United States, but the way that those companies, Amazon, Facebook, as you mentioned, Apple, are dealing internationally. I mean, they are changing the world. They're not just changing here. So maybe there is something in the confidence that these are our business leaders. These are the ones that are moving this world forward.
I think you do have to worry, though, because there is a time when the music stops. And that's when you think of it. You certainly saw it in the early 2000s and the late 1990s in technology stocks. You also saw it in the real estate market in 2007, 2008. We could talk about the impact that government had in fueling both of those bull markets and ultimately crashes. But I just don't think you can deny that real wealth is being created here in America, even among the folks who say they've been left behind and haven't seen their wages rise. I mean, when you look at the amount of technology that's available, you know, it's a supercomputer in your pocket. That's due to investors, that's due to innovators, and that's due to capitalism in America.
You know, capitalism gets a bad rap, especially when things are down. I mean, we saw in 2008 that there seemed to be a push towards, you know, capitalism being the ones or the system, because of the way that it runs, is why we saw the economy kind of crash out. Do you see it that way? I mean, you built your world, your mogul, your empire around the idea that capitalism is good. Do you see flaws in the system?
Well, unfortunately, that's the way the story was told by the previous administration and by most of the intellectuals in this country, that the economy crashed because of greedy capitalists, because of unfettered free markets. Of course, I mean, the financial markets were anything but free and unfettered before 2008. And in fact, the biggest blowups during that era were all the government-controlled entities, the Fannies, the Freddies, the all the mortgage lending banks that were directly under government's control. You know, I think, unfortunately, not only does capitalism get a bad rap, Justin, but it's getting even worse. I mean, you have the president, the Republican president of the United States, warning against free trade, how it's stealing jobs and hurting Americans and arguing for protectionism. So, you know, there's really no one out there anymore advocating, unfortunately, for free market capitalism. And I think until we get that, there's untold growth that will never occur. So we have a major transformation in that.
I mean, my only pushback in a light way is just that, As capitalism, you know, as the economy grows, we see much more inequality. We see we've now seen a more popular fight for, you know, the sort of 1% versus the 99%. We've seen wealth be concentrated among a very small set, and a lot of suffering and people that are living in poverty, and the poverty in the line continues to sort of go in an upward direction, meaning more people are under that line. So the question I have is just, you know, do you recognize that as a flaw in the system, that we see more and more inequality?
The gap between the rich and the poor is irrelevant. The inequality, as you put it, between, as long as the rich get rich by creating value, by earning in a free market system. And what you ultimately see, and I mean, Venezuela is very much in the news these days, Justin, obviously because of the collapse there. Not a lot of wealth inequality there. Everyone is truly equally poor. So what you tend to see in a capitalist system is wide wealth inequality, but those even on the so-called bottom doing very well by every standard imaginable. And you see that. I mean, quoting statistics about, you know, poverty are oftentimes kind of meaningless, but, you know, the so-called poor here are rich by any standard worldwide. So the gap between the rich and the poor is irrelevant as long as the rich become rich by creating values.
But I guess the part that's not being told is that because capitalism is a free market, you do have human tendencies, and the human tendencies seem to be biases, isms, whether it be racism or ageism or whatever, sexism. You start to see things creep into the idea of free market that are geared against people of class, of race, and other places that don't have the same opportunity. Jonathan, you paint this picture that, yes, it's free market. Go get it. But we find the people that continue to get money find a way to put one hand down on people that, for whatever reason, they don't want to go get it or be a part of it. So how do you deal with that part of human society when you're talking about free market and free trade?
I think capitalism is completely colorblind. I mean, my investors don't care.
But the people that are gaming capitalism are not. That's my point.
I don't understand what you mean by gaming.
Well, just the idea that they know how to play it. They go after it's free market trade. They're making money. And at a certain point, it feels more often that they're going, I also need to figure out a way to make sure that they don't make money, that the other people don't make money. I need to make more. It almost becomes competition.
Well, and competition is a good thing. And that's exactly what you want. You want companies competing for individuals' dollars. And if you can't compete, you don't succeed in capitalism. But I think, Justin, to suggest that, I mean, you talked about, you know, racial elements. I mean, you know, if you're a racist sandwich store and you say, I'm not going to serve Jews or blacks or whatever else, you're not going to stay in business for very long.
Right.
So being racist is actually terrible economics. It's immoral to begin with, but it's bad for business. So capitalism is truly, it's colorblind in a beautiful way. And as I said, I mean, my investors don't care what color I am, what gender I am, you know, who I sleep with. They want to make money. And that's the truth with most investors.
Yeah, I know. I hear exactly what you're saying. I mean, I understand the definition of it. I just think there's a lot of gray area when it comes to the free market and capitalism that doesn't get called out. This idea that there is institutional racism, there's institutional classism, there's this idea that some places are not going to invest based on not like, I think about neighborhoods and other places. We hear this all the time where you're like, well, why don't they invest in the neighborhoods? People, they don't see the opportunity there, and that because of their personal biases and things of that nature.
I mean, think about here in Chicago, for years, Walmart wanted to come invest on the South Side, evil capitalist Walmart. And who stopped them from coming in? The city.
Yeah.
The city wanted to put... So I just don't, so Walmart saw opportunity. I mean, Whole Foods saw opportunity in some depressed areas of the city to make investments. So I think if investors think they can make money, they will seek out those opportunities. So I kind of disagree fundamentally with you in this.
Oh,
way.
Absolutely we disagree. There's some, but that's okay. About, that's
though. Yeah.
That's what 20 years of knowing each other will do.
And these are conversations that are, you know, happen on college campuses and around dinner tables all the time, yeah. Which is great. I mean, too often I think people have a totally emotional, non-rational response to things like this. They say, capitalism good, socialism bad, or vice versa. Yeah. So to talk about it,
no,
I think
and I'm curious about it, and I'm open-minded to it. I I'm interested because Donald Trump and the president, and surprising too, because you're not necessarily, yeah, I mean, you're a conservative guy, but you're not someone who just automatically goes into the hook, line, and sinker of who the president is, meaning, you know, you're going to choose your people based on who you like, not necessarily.
Well, Donald,
party loyalty.
Donald Trump, unfortunately, is the worst example of a capitalist. Not for free trade, not for free press. Part of the reason I actually campaigned for Secretary Clinton was that I was afraid that Donald Trump was going to give capitalism a terrible name, and I think he's doing exactly that.
But he
that.
Ran on the idea that he was a capitalist, that he was a
successful businessman.
And this idea that America voted for a businessman to come in and put business. He talked about it. I just was watching something. He's talking about the brilliant business minds that he wants to bring to Washington. Is Donald Trump a capitalist? Like a good capitalist?
No, he's the opposite. I mean, his idea of a good business mind is to put a 40% import tax on everything we buy from Amazon to bring, I don't know, low-skilled assembly line jobs back to Iowa. I don't know. I mean, his, you know, to be a capitalist is to believe in freedom, is to believe in the individual's ability to make his or her own choices and not to be coerced by anyone else. That's not what Donald Trump's about. I mean, Donald Trump, the whole notion of America first, he's going to use force for you to buy American, hire American. Oh, not him, of course. I mean, he's got his own special deals on the side. But, I mean, this is just the opposite of what freedom and free markets are about. So Trump is the worst example of a capitalist, and unfortunately.
And I guess the question I would ask is that, and you have a lot of these arguments on Fox, and I've seen them, you know, over the years, but the concept of government, is our government and the politicians that are the lawmakers, I would say, that are politicians that are running it, Are they running a capitalist system? I mean, because more often than not, we see little changes to it. Healthcare is a good example where that's not necessarily how it was drawn up by, you know, the founders of capitalism. But I mean, is the government honoring the system that we choose as a country to run?
No, and they haven't been for decades, and we're going in exactly the wrong direction, Justin. I mean, government has one role: protect people's rights, leave them free, and protect people's rights. And as you alluded to, I mean, now government is involved in every element of life, certainly in the medical field, and even before Obamacare, government, spent something like 51% of all medical dollars, and now in business even more and more. I mean, Obama was certainly anti-business, but Trump wants to control trade, and you have basically two ways of dealing with people, by force or by trade. Trade is how we deal with other people safely and rationally in a free economy. So the fact that Trump is so insistent on wanting to control who you buy from, how much you pay, what industries succeed and fail, I think bodes really poorly for the economy moving forward.
You know, and yet, I mean, we see the economy seems to show some signs of rebound, and specifically Wall Street. I mean, we talked about the Dow at the beginning of the segment. I'm surprised because as somebody who I found more often than not in the last 10, 20 years, I mean, I guess it goes back for a while now, that Wall Street has become a political player. That you'll hear a political speech from D.C., you'll then hear from the opposition party, and then we all watch to see what Wall Street does. Has it always been that way? Has money, big money in this country and the financial district had a political voice?
It's terrible. I mean, there should be complete separation between the economy and the government. And unfortunately, I think I really noticed it since the 2000 tech crash. I mean, after the technology crash, you didn't see major programs from government to stimulate this job or that job. Investors licked their wounds and new companies started to get created and built. But now I think you're right, Justin. I mean, every element from Washington has a supposed effect of jerry-rigging the economy, impacting the economy.
Yeah, changing interest rates and things of that
nature. Yeah, I mean, it's all about micromanaging. And it's the, you know, it's the reason why it's the reason why you don't want to buy a – it's the reason why you would never want to buy an East German Trabant. I mean, it's the best thing I can come from. If you would ever want to buy a centrally planned or a Yugo, it's the reason why these cars, these centrally planned cars over history have always failed, whereas the free Fords and General Motors thrive. So central planning always fails, and it's failed throughout the world. It's going to fail in the U.S.
Does Wall Street, though, and I think about the big people in Wall Street, the Goldman Sachs and the others, they like that, though. They like they are political. They like the people at the top seem to, I mean, relish in the fact that they have a voice and they're able to whisper in the ear of politicians.
For one thing, I think it's hard to kind of categorize, say, Wall Street.
Right.
It's somewhat of a smear term. It's like saying the media likes this and that, or there's a lot of different elements
sure.
of the media.
Sure.
I think, unfortunately, there are some cronies in the financial world, just as there's cronies in all elements of business, pull peddlers who go to Washington, spend money and try to get favors. I think the problem, though, is that we allow government to give those favors. So if you got government out of regulating, got government out of granting special monopolies, special favors to certain types of businesses, got government out of the economy, all these cronies, all these interventionists, all these lobbyists would disappear completely because there'd be nothing for them to
right.
lobby for.
That's a good point. But I also feel that the government's role, whether it was designed to be this or not, is a protectionist role in the way that there is nothing worse to and then having your money at one day, whether it be through a house or through stock market or whatever, and the next day, it's gone. There's just nothing. I mean, there's no other nightmare that is close to that for any American that is listening right now. And the government
it's like when I get my paycheck and they take Social Security out, and all of a sudden 7% is gone.
Well, that Social Security is. I mean, the goal there it seems to be is this is for when you need it. Meaning we're going to develop these safety blankets, these nets. We're going to make sure that if the bank fails, your money is okay. I mean, that's to me is where some of the government regulation works in a way that we've seen time and time again in our system in capitalism, where the someone's recklessness has created more trouble for people who weren't reckless, and they are feeling the effect in the terms that it ruins their life. So I actually am okay with the regulation. I think there is a point where it's over-regulation, and that's where we saw a lot with the Obama administration, and Trump has vowed to change that. But the idea of stripping it all away doesn't seem to jive with me.
Well, can you give me an example of what you described where someone's recklessness ruined someone?
I would say the guys doing the subprime stuff in 2008.
So the people who
are hedging bets against themselves, or you know what I mean, like the Big Short.
The people who are betting on the market going down.
Right.
Well,
or the people who were in the subprime world, and I'm trying to think of how that all works.
Sure, the people who are writing mortgages that they knew
that they shouldn't. Yeah, right.
Well, I mean, government is unfortunately at the middle of that, Justin. I mean, they were writing those mortgages they knew would never get paid because they knew they could sell them to Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, the government-sponsored entities.
So the safety net, they essentially hedged against the safety net. They knew there was a safety net so they could do anything they wanted.
The government safety net, as you said, offered the opportunity for people to exploit it. So, I mean, I think unfortunately, it's exactly as you said. I mean, no one bothers to check the credibility of their doctor because they say, oh, it's all right. They have the license from the government. Or no one bothers to actually look at if someone can drive a cab or not. Well, they've got the license and the regulation from the city. And the same thing when it comes to the bank. No one bothers to check, is this a financially sound bank? Well, they've got FDIC insurance. So regulation doesn't stop the problems.
Right.
I actually think it just makes them more difficult to detect.
I mean, that's an interesting way to look at it, that if there wasn't the regulation there, you're saying that the free market would correct itself. It wouldn't offer – it wouldn't try to be as reckless as it is because – there would be nothing to save it.
That's exactly right.
And
I think there's a bigger, broader question here, Justin. That, I mean, government almost says, you know, you're smart enough to make money, but too stupid to know what to do with it. I think the moral issue here is that you have a right to your own life. And if you want to, I don't know, have a – I'm just trying to think of an example off the top of my head. If you want to
– a merengue boat party.
Yeah, I mean, you want if you want to have a merengue boat party and maybe not put seatbelts necessarily on certain elements of the boat, or even better, not have a non-smoking section. If you want to have a restaurant and say this is going to be a smoking restaurant, That's our rules. Everyone wants to come, government regulators are going to come shut you down. I mean, that's what ultimately regulation does.
Jonathan Honig, the capitalist pig, who is a money manager. He also is a regular on Fox News Channel, and he talks about money. His new photo novella is called The Pit. It's a photographic portrait of the Chicago trading floor. You can find out more at thepitchicago.com. Jonathan, great to see you.
Thank you, Justin.
And thanks for coming in. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, we continue our Lollapalooza week here on the Download, featuring musicians, artists, and personalities in town for the big festival this weekend in Grant Park. One of the great things about the festival are the events and after parties that are happening all over the city. Tomorrow, there's a live broadcast of Sway in the Morning. Of course, that show is one of the biggest in hip-hop and entertainment, airing on SiriusXM. The show will be broadcast from the First Ward Chop Shop in Wicker Park. You can come watch. The broadcast starts at 7 a.m. Sway, of course, the popular personality who's created an empire at SiriusXM. The DJ originally came up as a rapper, but he quickly rose to prominence as a reporter and executive producer for MTV News. But it's Sway's time at Sirius that made him an instrumental voice in hip-hop. Whether it's deep interviews with the biggest names or my favorite, the segment Five Fingers of Death, which has artists freestyle different beats in studio, Sway is must-listen-to viral content. The latest one with Chicagoan Vic Mensa, unreal.
Yeah. Turn them headphones up, man. Swear it all goes down.
I don't want to talk about no beef. I don't like pork and I don't like police. They'd rather I don't speak than to hear a black man speak his mind. But I'm a rap genius. You got to read between the lines. I guess I'm playing with their hands now. Just to make sure that they don't forget. I let them argue all day in the barbershop about who's the best MCs. Kendrick, Cole, and Vic, please. Don't let them distract you with the nonsense. When did art turn into content? I'm still in Chicago. I've been the king. I ain't never had to leave to get a ring on some Levine-ish. This bar's for the victims lost in Orlando. There's a lot of hate, but love is the strongest ammo. Presidential candidates on the channels like Kerry Washington, the way they profiting off a scandal. But we just keep it real the most.
Sway will be in Chicago tomorrow morning for his show and for Lollapalooza, but he is here first tonight on the Download. Sway, thanks for joining us. We appreciate it.
Hey, man, I almost didn't know who you were talking about, Justin, when you were describing that guy.
Coming to Chicago to do a live show. Talk about, first, how often do you get through town?
You know, I've come to Chicago since the 1990s. I used to be on a radio station called We Jams in Chicago.
Right.
I was doing a syndicated show called The Wake Up Show with my partner, King Tech. And because we were on that station, we would come and do, like, DJ battles and the whole nine. I'm from Oakland, so Chicago reminds me a lot of Oakland, California. And both cities kind of experience the same adversity, whether, you know, you're talking about street politics or city government. It's dense in Oakland like it is in Chicago. So I felt comfortable in Chicago. I've come every year for probably the past 10 years. We've done broadcasts in Chicago probably for the past 4 or 5 years. You know, I was there when President Barack Obama was accepted the nomination. I've come to Chicago often. I got great friends in Chicago. And I've known Kanye since he first started. Common and I, our careers have ran parallel. So I say all this to say I'm a big fan of Chicago, and I try to come every year.
Doing a live show of your broadcast, and your broadcast viral, anyone who is a fan of hip-hop knows your show because a lot of the material that's on the show ends up on YouTube or other places and is consumed by the masses. To come to Chicago and do the show in front of a live audience, do you like doing that? Do you like getting out of the studio and doing something in front of an audience, a radio program?
I think you and me are probably similar in that way because I could tell by your energy and the clips I've seen of you online that you're a people's person and like to communicate, you know. So you're doing your shows all the time. I'm doing my shows all the time. And it's great when you can make a connection through frequency and airwaves and, you know, and all of those things. But there's nothing like at the human contact, being able to see the people that actually support and invested in what you do every day and vice versa. I mean, my objective in that morning show, it could get kind of, you know, it's uncensored radio. So the lyrical content could get kind of harsh. But when we break the mic, you know, we really try to bring substance or we try to bring joy, laughter. You know, we're very comfortable. There's nothing scripted, and I like to have that experience with people in person. I like to have that feeling. I like to shake your hand. I'm very interested, like, the fact that you like the Five Fingers of Death. You know, that's a really popular segment. And it fascinates me because it's something I like. So we have that in common. So I like that it entertains folks. So it means that your show is making an impact on people's lives. Sometimes people call up here to yell at us, and we get into these great arguments. And by the end of the conversation, it's like, man, well, I'll hear from you tomorrow with your dumb ass. But we love you, you know.
To be a voice, to be in that seat on Sway in the Morning on Sirius XM and have the hip-hop world come through and be able to tell their stories, get deep, to, you know, perform live, put themselves in situations that may not be controlled, that's huge. You become almost, an observer of the hip-hop scene. Tell us about today's generation, the musicians that are coming up that will be featured on your show, and how you see hip-hop moving forward and evolving. What do you see from today's newer generation and artists that are coming through the program as opposed to the ones that came through 5, 10, 15 years ago?
I find them fascinating. You know why? Because I think they're very resilient. They're very cocky. You know, they're really, surely they're somewhat entitled. You know, they don't care as much about the history or. And that's a broad statement, not all of them, but a lot of folks we've learned that from. And then there's some, you know, I have an 18-year-old daughter who's a historian buff and challenges me on lyrics that Kendrick says compared to lyrics that Future says, or, you know, that side of it, too. Right. I find it fascinating because they're functioning without the limitations that we had coming up in the game. When I was an artist, we had technological limitations. We had mental limitations, we have societal limitations that we were dealing with that are more dense, I think, than this generation. So they don't have the same limitations. So the kind of music they're making is different. You know, we have rules, you know, well, man, you can't really be singing if you're going to call yourself a hip-hop artist. You're not a real rapper. You're not a spitter. You know, we came up in that day and age of now if you don't sing, you're not a full artist. You know what I mean?
Right.
Singing was frowned upon. Certain things you wore was frowned upon. If you like rock, you know, all these different things, these limitations we set for ourselves. You know, when you hear a Ray Shrimmer and Swayze and you hear these guys, how they structure songs, how they write, how they play with melodies, when you really dig into what is Future doing, maybe, you know, he's not as lyrical as Kendrick, but he's creating something that's appealing. What's at the core of that? What's at the sweet spot of that? And there wasn't nobody who could sound like Future in 1988 or 91 and get away with it.
And another thing, too, we here in Chicago, we're going to see a Lollapalooza on Saturday night, Chance the Rapper, and headline the whole festival. It's amazing to think about he being an independent artist who went all the way and won a Grammy. And it looks to me now that independent artists has become a genre. You know, you can almost see it. If you do a drop down menu on Apple Music, it'll be independent. Talk about how hip hop artists in general have taken that idea of being independent outside of the record industry, outside of the record labels, and made a name for themselves.
I think it's amazing. I think it's what it was always meant to be realized. You know, back in the Sugar Hill days and, you know, back in the Rapper's Delight days and Sugar Hill Gang Records, you know, the creators had no control over the industry. You had the music execs and you had, you know, those who danced on stage and sang on mics, you know, the producers, the songwriters, the performers, but they didn't control the infrastructure. They didn't control how and when their songs were being released. They didn't control their artwork. Some of them didn't even control their promo pictures, let alone what single was going to be released or who's going to write the song or who's going to produce it. Now you're in a day and age where you could do all of that all by yourself. I was talking to Vic Mensa about his autobiography project and how much, you know, he got no idea to produce on it. You know, that's, you know, we all know mentor Kanye and just did Jay-Z's album, and he was able to have that choice. Back then, you might not have that choice. I think it's great to watch it now. We just saw these studies that have shown that hip-hop is the most powerful, highest-selling genre, most influential genre right now, overpassing rock. And wow. I think the streaming technology has helped people realize how big hip-hop really is and how impactful it is across the globe, across the board, across any genre. You know, but this is really a dream realized. This is kind of cyclical because in the 80s, you had a similar revolution happening, when the music business was just really hard to break into. So you had guys like Eazy-E create a Ruthless Records, Too Short have a record label called 75 Girls, and doing independent distribution through independent distributors like California Record Distributors or City Hall Distribution that dealt with mostly local talent. This is taking place in the 80s. So Jay Prince in Houston starting Rap-A-Lot Records. And I'm sure there was people in Chicago doing it independent as well. You know, Pope Pimp Project and all those things. I think those are all, if I'm not mistaken, independent. But we were independent. The behemoth infrastructure of the music business still swallowed us up because we didn't have enough tools. This digital age allowed kids to really change the way music is being heard and listened to. And the music business didn't really adjust to it properly quick enough. So now the power pendulum has switched. And now it's in the hands of the creators. You know, it's almost like being on a plantation and the overseer's handing the guns to the slaves.
we're talking with Sway, of course, from Sway in the Morning, the wildly popular show on SiriusXM, as you heard every morning. It's going to be broadcast live from First Ward Chop Shop in Wicker Park tomorrow morning. 7 a.m. Is the broadcast start time at Chop Shop in Wicker Park, of course, in town for Lollapalooza. You mentioned, you know, Vic Mensa, and we talked a little bit about Chance, but Chicago has a really robust scene right now when it comes to hip-hop. For those listening in WGN who might not necessarily know those names, for you being almost the spokesperson for hip-hop right now, what do you think of the artists that are coming out of Chicago from a national lens?
You said something earlier that I never really considered, but I'm an observer now. I'm a fan. You know, I'm somewhat of a historian who's lucky enough to be able to play in the sandbox with the other kids. You know what I mean? So when I look at Chicago, I recognize something. You know, I always try to stay in the moment and always try to recognize when you're in a moment. And we've seen cycles. You know, we've seen this happen in hip-hop, at least always, since day one. New York was the mecca, and it had a tight hold on the music business, and it even had a tight hold on the trends or the zeitgeist of your average music lover or hip-hop fan. Then we watched it go to the West Coast and Death Row and N.W.A. and that what they call gangster rap. Then the game started switching over to the West Coast, you know. Then we watched it go to Chicago. Common had a good run. The Brat, you know, Twista, you know, with a lot of things, Crucial Conflict, Chicago made some noise. But Atlanta's New Orleans got it. Atlanta got it. You know, and it goes in circles. The Bay had it. Chicago's been having it. Watching what Chicago's doing. Now it's room for every multiple markets to really have a tight grip on the music game. But because the listener is broadened now, and then the access is easier. So when you look at the Bibbies, you look at Bibby and these guys, G Herbo, you know, Chief Keef, Lil Durk, you look at all these people. You know, Dreezy coming out of Chicago, these kids that came off the streets and was talking about what was going on in their neighborhoods. You look at their social media, you see them living in L.A., hanging out at great parties, driving great cars. They look clean. We talked to Bibby about growing up in Chicago and then him dropping out of high school because he just didn't see where high school was going to benefit him. And now being able to make a living as a young man, as an artist, has changed and opened his eyes. So we talked to him about completing what he stopped, getting his high school diploma. And we convinced him on air to get his high school diploma. He went and got it, became a straight-A student, and now he's thinking about going to college.
Yeah, that's right. That's amazing. He and G Herbo came through not too long ago on this show for listeners listening to this. They told the stories about their lives and how it affects them and how their art essentially is reflective of those experiences. Being in the center and having all these kids come through and tell their story, how do you get them to talk? You know, because hip-hop has always had the chip on the shoulder, I have to have this attitude, almost a character, where I need to be street, I need to be hard, I need to just answer my questions as succinct as possible. But when I watch them talk with you and there's a level of respect, it seems like they want to open up and do something that's a little deeper. How do you draw that out?
I'm not doing anything in particular, Justin. I'm going to be honest with you. I think what it is we all kind of, like, you're very professional, really I think you're great at what you do. You're engaging. You sound crisp and clean. And I mean that in a great way. And I trust you. That's why I'm this open with you. With the artists, a lot of the hip-hop artists, it's just a lot of pressure sometimes to be something or to continue something or to live up to something, or everything I'm going to say is going to be scrutinized, and who is this person asking me? I have no agenda. And I think besides whoever I hang out with, I don't have no big crew, I don't claim nothing, I don't wear jewelry, I don't brag about money, but I will let you know I'm genuinely interested in you as a person, and then how does that inform your artistry? Not you as an artist, and how does that inform who you are as a person? And I think when people can see that your heart and your intent is good, they're willing to open up. Not everybody opens up to me. Maybe not everybody catches that read. But I'm not trying to embarrass you to make a name for my radio show or go viral. Or I'm not playing the game, the industry game that we work in. It's a game you can play, and you can maneuver your way to a certain height. You know, you could say things that you know will make you popular the next day, but at what cost? I've never compromised, and I think people respect that. So when they come to talk to us, I think they realize that, he ain't up to nothing. If he wants to know, he genuinely wants to ask you, hey, man, why did y'all get into a fight? Right. What was that about? You know, I'm not asking because I'm thinking of the headline. And I think that's what it is, Justin. And then also, I've done radio since the 90s, and people have watched me interview.
Yeah, they know you. Right. We're talking with Sway. Sway, of course, from Sway in the Morning on Sirius XM, a longtime radio host, but also a reporter and executive producer at MTV News and all sorts of stuff. The show will be live on stage tomorrow morning at First Ward Chop Shop in Wicker Park. The broadcast starts at 7 a.m. Who are you going to have on the show? Is that hidden? Is that a secret? Or can you tell us who's going to be on?
It's always a secret, Justin. And if I was to tell you right now, I would have had to kidnap you. But
I got more show to do tonight.
We always have people. I'll tell you this, we're going to feature our Friday Fire Cypher.
Oh, that's
and
great.
We're letting anybody from Chicago who could get there in time, and we have enough time, we're going to let people show off their skills for the first time. They could do it on Say 4-5 and be heard by anywhere up to 32 million
that's
people.
That's amazing. So, what an opportunity. Yeah.
Yeah, it's 2033.
West North Avenue. Right there in Wicker Park, and we've had a lot of Chop Shop stuff on. It's right at North and Damon in Wicker Park. Sway, it's a pleasure to have you on the program. Thanks so much for taking some time out, and good luck with the broadcast tomorrow.
Thank you, brother. Hopefully you can stop by, man. I respect you, man. Thanks for having me.
Everybody outside wanna pull up outside all night though. Everybody high five, everybody wanna smile, everybody wanna lie, that's nice, no. Oh, now you wanna chill, oh, now you wanna build, oh, now you got the bill, that's cool though. Oh, now you got the gas, oh, now you wanna laugh, oh, now you need a cab, that's true though.
All you do is talk, I ain't got this to say. Can't no one get in my car, I don't even valet.
Long discussions, oh, you my cousin? No, you wasn't. You just want to ride. You just want to talk about politics, Chicago, this shit, rock this shit. Start dancing, boy.
All night at the chicken, 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 all night.
It's been a steady flow of Lollapaloozers who have come through past the Michigan Avenue studio in the last half hour. Good to talk with Sway. The Brooklyn-based band Sloth Rust coming up next. They're in studio. Talk to them about their career, their music, and that they're playing Lollapalooza tomorrow. Hopefully they will not be rained out. it's during the day. But this band, alternative rock band that is getting a lot of buzz for their sound. They sound a lot like... It's fun because the Lollapalooza site has a funny way that someone described them. Nirvana meets Wynton Marsalis. Right? That's intriguing. So we'll talk with them coming up here after the news. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. Well, that's we've been talking about all night. We're continuing our coverage of Lollapalooza, which is underway today in Grand Park and plays through the weekend. Tomorrow afternoon, Lolla welcomes the Brooklyn-based band Sloth Rust. Call Sloth Rust a rock band may work on the surface, but if you listen a little bit closer, the band draws from jazz, blues, and other forms of music to create a sound that's all their own. It's a sound that's reminiscent of some greats from the alt-rock days of the 90s, drawing comparisons to bands like Smashing Pumpkins, or as Leah quoted on the Lolla website, it's kind of like Nirvana meets Wynton Marsalis. Sloth Rust just put out the album Everyone Else, which everyone loves. In addition to being on stage tomorrow at Lollapalooza, they'll be on stage at Bottom Lounge later tonight for an after party. Sloth Rust is a trio featuring Leah Welbaum on guitar and lyrics, Kyle Bann on bass, and Will Gorin on drums, and they are in studio tonight. Guys, thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having us. Yeah.
So congrats. Welcome to Chicago. How often do you guys get through here, and what are some of the memories of playing Chicago?
I would say we come through Chicago a couple times a year, and we actually love coming to Chicago. It's definitely one of our favorite cities. It's one of the cities that I feel like that we first played to like a really packed room where everyone knew the lyrics and we were super surprised by it because we're not from here.
Right.
So, yeah, go Chicago.
Playing Lollapalooza, what's it mean to you guys? What's it mean to get a chance to get up on stage at a festival like that?
Well, we've never played a proper festival before like this, so we're definitely really excited and curious. I don't think any of us have particular expectations, just excited to see what it's all about.
I had asked a couple bands this week, do you have to change the way that you approach your show playing a festival? I mean, you haven't played a festival like this, but do you change a set list? Do you change the way you guys are set up? What goes into actually playing a festival when you're used to playing in clubs?
I guess we're going to find out.
Yeah, I think that when you play outside, the sound quality is just different. Personally, I really like playing outside. I think a lot of musicians do not because it's just hard for the sound to be contained, but I just really like feeling the air, the breeze, if you will. But I think we're pretty consistent. We generally try to play what we want to play and sort of follow our heart in that sense, but try to be aware of the crowd and maybe like what the energy level is like.
The idea of playing a festival, especially in the daytime, you get a lot of people who might be curious, who are checking you guys out, may not necessarily be there for your set, but are kind of sampling. I would think like playing in a sea of people where you're not necessarily connecting in the way that you can see how they're rocking out to you because it's a blend changes the way musicians approach the energy of a show.
We like mix up the set list pretty much every time we play. So I think that when we get there and like we'll write something down on the piece of paper, but Leah goes off book like a lot of times and she might just like start playing a different song and like, you know, it's like, well, if she starts playing one, I'm not about to like argue with you on stage. So so the set list might change at the drop of a hat.
You know? Worse is the idea of changing a set list in the moment. There's been a lot written about you guys at your roots in jazz and blues, but where does the idea of just kind of going with the flow and as musicians catching up to each other?
I think it's really important to vibe off of other people's energy and sort of embrace that. And I don't really believe in playing songs that you don't want to play unless you have to for some reason. So if I'm looking at a song on the set list and then I'm like, you know, I'm not feeling that one right now. I'll just skip it or bring it back later depending on the vibe. I think it's more important that we're all having a good time and that you're receptive to what people are giving you in the audience and what you're giving out than it is to just stick to the plan.
Yeah.
And we all love improv. I think it's fun to keep everyone on the balls of their feet. Is that the expression?
Yeah.
Balls of their toes.
That's good. Balls of your feet.
I was like, what am I saying?
No, that works. Improv plays a big role in all of you as musicians. How do you make sure that everybody's in that space when you don't set out improvising? When, as musicians, you set out with a song and you play it and you're in the third song and Leah's like, let's try something different. How do you make sure that Will is paying attention, like ready to go with a with improv in the moment?
Well, I think that the three of us have been playing together in so many bands over the last like 10 years now that we just know each other pretty well as musicians and kind of, and we listen to each other on stage so we can kind of like, it's like I can guess what Leah's going to do next a little bit or what Kyle might do and kind of anticipate each other's moves.
Reading a lot of your stuff, there's comparisons, or at least they pull out the idea of your discipline when it comes to jazz and blues music and how it's incorporated into what Sloth Russ does. How accurate is that? I mean, is that something that as you find yourself really playing on your jazz roots, your blues roots, the different kinds of genre that don't necessarily on the surface play out with Sloth Russ and the music that we hear?
I mean, I feel like we come at it, it's like more than like a direct, you know, drawing like a specific musical ideals from those genres. It's more that we just like incorporate sort of a jazz sensibility into anything else that we play.
Yeah.
So sort of the spirit of an anything can happen kind of nature, especially like during the writing phase, we always experiment a great deal, you know, and like parts get tried and then thrown out and, you know, chords get changed and altered and all that type of thing. And people take solos and, you know, eventually a lot of those improvisations sort of get written into the song.
Do you find that being in, you mentioned you played with each other for so long, but you guys also played with a lot of other bands. Do you find that that's not a shared sensibility when it comes to rock music? The idea that that there is experimentation and improvisation incorporated in both the writing process and the performance?
I think we're all on board with that. It's definitely something we all embrace, is trying to like really listen to each other as players, which is something I think we learned in playing different genres of music, both together and independently. I think that really helps take playing to the next level and helps sort of craft material and live performance in a way that feels most natural and present.
You do a lot of the songs that are on the record, Everyone Else, were songs that you were able to try out before you got to the recording process. You got to get on stage and experiment and try different things. You know, we've had a lot of bands on the show that will go in a different direction that don't want to do that. They don't want to put stuff up there and try in front of an audience that, you know, it may not work or mm-hmm. it may have a different result. Where does that come from, the idea of using the stage, the time that you have there to work on material that later point might be on a record?
Well, yeah, and I think that goes back to this idea of the exchange of energy and feeling how the same song might feel to play to different types of audiences, smaller, larger, and different types of spaces in different cities. I think that's sort of allows you to get to know the song in a lot of different contexts. And for us, we like to go into the recording process having a sense of that already.
In a way, it's probably pretty exciting to try new stuff in front of different audiences. Are you guys the kind of musicians that are okay if it doesn't go well? You know, do you learn from the mistakes? If you put something up there and you're like, well, that worked at the one club and now we're in a different town and it didn't work as well. Do you guys recognize that? Do you talk afterward and say, okay, let's fix that?
You know, it kind of depends, but something that I really like about the three of us that I think makes us high-functioning is that all of us like to leave it on the stage. You know, none of us are going to nitpick each other's playing or nitpick our own playing, because what's the point in it, you know? It's good to have mm-hmm. a level of self-reflection, but it's more important to give what you can to the performance in the moment. And I think that is also something that comes a lot from the blues and the jazz tradition.
The band Sloth Russ in studio tonight. Leah Welbaum, Kyle Bann, and Will Gorin in studio there at Lollapalooza tomorrow afternoon. They're also tonight coming up here at 11 o'clock, shows at 11 o'clock at Bottom Lounge on Lake Street, doing one of the after parties for Lollapalooza, playing with the band The Pretty Reckless. There's a lot of times that people will talk about their writing process. And sometimes they'll talk about how that writing process is stunted when they have to tour on a record. So, you know, they'll go through this process. They're going, it's just nonstop on the road. They don't really get a chance to breathe. With you guys, it seems that you use that time and that experience to be on the road together to write, to work on new material. How do you guys as writers, when you're talking about new material, view the time that you spend on the road?
You know, I think that we're sort of in the process of figuring out that balance, because we've never toured as much as we have this past year and a half. It's definitely been going really hard. And this record that we put out in the fall was written before that. Now we're in the stages of working on the next one and figuring out, you know, the best writing process for that. But I think the most important thing is just to stay open-minded mm-hmm. and let it happen.
Can you find space on the tour to think about new music, to think about things that aren't necessarily in the next gig that is only hours away?
Well, we definitely like take advantage of when we can. We'd like to take advantage of sound checks to maybe play some of the newer songs that aren't quite ready to necessarily play in front of like an audience, but maybe almost getting there. And you know, if we nail it in soundcheck, maybe we'll play it that night.
Kyle, a lot has been paid to the way that this is, that you guys have worked through, and what we heard on the record on Everyone Else, there's this balance that the sound that you guys have right now is the Sloth Rust sound, that you guys got it nailed down. When you think about that as a band, the idea that you come to this album and you're like, yes, we've got it, this is our sound, these songs are great, everyone loves it, does it stunt your growth in the sense that the next album you may not want to experiment or go in a different direction because you got so much success off the songs that you just put out on the record before?
Yeah, that's definitely an issue that we, and I think pretty much every musician faces, is when you're, you know, putting out material that people seem to enjoy, it becomes very easy to like fall into that formula. And we find ourselves doing that as well. It's like, you know, after we've been a band for this long, we make the joke in band practice, like, oh, what would Sloth Rust do here, you know? And so I guess sort of with, you know, new records and stuff, you got to ask that question and then not do that. You know what I mean? Like, what would Sloth Rust do here? And then,
well, how do you push yourself away? Yeah. How do you push yourself away from that and push the limits of what you guys have accomplished, but also move in a direction that is going to keep you moving forward?
I think you just have to be intentional and listen to music that is further outside of your genre and think about what you like about that and what sort of textures and sounds you like, and just be unafraid of it. Just run with it.
Yeah, I think trying to play with things outside of your comfort zones and like play maybe different styles of music that necessarily we haven't played in a long time, especially in band practice, and also just having space to like open jam and not necessarily play music with the intention of writing a song and just play music for the intention of playing music.
Well, I would think that the relationship that the three of you have and the ability to fall back on that relationship when trying new things or pushing you guys outside of the comfort zone has to be a plus for a band like this. If you guys didn't trust each other as musicians, it may be a little tougher to be like, I got this new idea and I want to go in this area because, you know, you're having so much success off the stuff that's already been put out. Is that true?
Yeah, I suppose so. I think one thing that has helped us that I would advise bands do more is switch instruments. I think that really can open things up a lot and create space to just experiment more. And sometimes the sensibility that you have on an instrument that you don't play every single night is very different and can actually create just depth that wouldn't necessarily be there otherwise.
And I think that it sort of helps you develop like a certain amount of musical empathy for your bandmates, you know, like when you like sit behind the drum set and you're like, oh man, this is like a lot harder than Will, you know, makes it look. And, you know, it sort of gives you an appreciation of like what is in that person's mind at that moment, which makes you better able to interact with them.
All right. So what's next? You got the shows here at Lollapalooza, which is a huge get, but you're still on tour. You said you got a new album that you're working on, or at least starting to work on new music. Is the goal here to get a new album and rinse and repeat, go back on tour and continue the success that you guys have had the last year?
I suppose we'll see. We're going to Europe this fall for the first time. So I think that will be a really exciting experience to play these same songs in a super different context and see how it goes. And it's also a good time to try cutting our teeth on this new material and see what evolves out of that. And ultimately, see what works with our schedule, you know?
Sloth Rust on stage tomorrow in the afternoon at Lollapalooza. They're also on stage coming up here right after this at Bottom Lounge on Lake Street for an after party. Leah Welbaum, Kyle Benn, and Will Gorin in studio. Guys, thanks so much for coming in and sharing your story and talking about the music. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. I'm going to leave you anywhere. We'll be right back.
That's going to do it tonight for The Download. Patty Vasquez coming up next here on 720 WGN. What an eventful night tonight as the storms kind of come through now and they're past. A Lollapalooza evacuation in Grant Park that ended the festival a little bit early. I'm not sure. I have to ask Rob if they were able to go back up on stage, if they evacuated and then brought him back to finish, because, you know, that clip that he was playing of Lord, she was like, I'll be back.
I think she meant back in a few months. I don't think they were allowed to come back.
I did see a tweet from Matt Bellamy of Muse, and he said that hopefully they'll invite them back to make up for it.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, so they only got three songs in.
Yeah. Well, maybe that could have been Liam Gallagher's excuse.
He didn't like the clouds?
If you had just waited before he did his apology on Twitter, of course, tonight, Liam Gallagher of Oasis earlier tonight, he walked off the set three songs in, then he tweeted a little bit later saying that he had a tough night last night, tough gig, and he apologized, but his voice couldn't handle it. So if he would have just waited just a little bit longer, he could have just got caught up in the generic history that Lala was evacuated. He could be like, well, I was on stage. Then people say, no, you were on earlier. And he'd be like, you know, potato, potato. Muse got three songs. Lord got three songs. I got three songs. That's what you can do, you know. I think I have a funny story. Did I ever tell this story? My brother, he's a huge Oasis guy. And, you know, he's 5 years younger than me, and Oasis sort of plays in that. He just was really into all those bands, Blur, Oasis.
Yeah.
He went and saw him at Chicago Theater, and he was he's like a kind of a massive fan. Like, he followed them, he knew their stuff. And he was on the side of the stage when it was over, and there was the big tour bus. And he was watching closely as one of the guys walked up and put a code into the door of the bus. It was like 1234, right? And my brother and his friend, they're like, I saw the code. And my brother, I don't know what came over him, but he's like, hit the code. Let's see what happens. 1234. And it opened. And so he gets on. And he walks onto the bus, the tour bus.
Oh, my God.
Of Oasis, which is idling on Lake Street next to the Chicago Theater.
Mm-hmm.
He walks in. And he says, you know, he tells the story. He's like, I walked in and it's, you know, nobody in the front of the bus, but you can tell, like, behind the curtain or whatever in the back, there's the party going on or something. So he just goes for it. He walks in. He's like, what's up, guys? And it was Noel. And Liam wasn't there, I don't think. But maybe he was. It was pretty much the whole band. And they just kind of, like, one of the guys had a guitar in his hand. And he kind of looked up, and it was like a scratch of the record. And they're like, who you? And one of the guys, like you said, the bass player jumped up, like, ready to punch him. And, like, or maybe it was a manager or something. I don't think the musicians moved, but it was like somebody got up, like, you know, we're going to kick your ass. And what happened was, I think it was one of the guys. It might have been Noah. I was like, so let me just get this straight. You're just some wanker who just walked on the bus? He's like, yeah, man. And they're like, wow. Like, you go long. Like, they just were, like, amazed but mad. But they were amazed. Like, I can't believe you did that.
Yeah.
And, like, the manager grabbed him by the shirt, and they walked him to the front, and then they threw him forcefully down off the bus and out of the bus, and that was it.
They didn't arrest him,
They didn't
though.
Arrest him or anything. He should have been arrested. He should have been. I mean, it would have been awesome if it, like, affected his life. Like, he couldn't get trying to get a job right now. And they're like, it says here you have an arrest record for jumping on the Oasis bus and tangling with the bass player. No, it was, you know, he was young. He was 19 years old or something.
That's a great story, though. You never got arrested.
He never got arrested. I had to ask him. We should call him up and have him on the show one of these nights just to talk about, like, what was actually said. Because it was hilarious when, let me get this straight. Like, one of the main guys, I think it was Noel Gallagher, was like, so let me get this straight.
I wish there was video of it.
I know, right?
They'd be up there with, you know, those two guys that are chasing Hank Aaron after he hits his record breaking home run. You know, those two white guys that are
all
running.
Right, man, all right, I got long hair and big mustache. Yeah, I'm gonna chase this guy. Yeah,
oh,
no,
that's really funny.
And it was kind of a pre smartphone world. You know, so there were not even photos. Because I'll bet you, if he would have done it now, he would be walking in with the video going.
Yeah.
On your phone. But this was a pre. This would have been probably early 2000s.
Yeah.
2004, 2005, something like that.
All the Kaufmans are trendsetters.
Yeah. Jumping on the bus. That's what I'm going to do next time we go to Chicago Theater. The bus pops up and be like, what's the code? 1, 2, 3, 4. I always try it.
When I worked, I'd take the train and get off at Lake, and then I'd go walk towards the Prudential Building. So I'd always see, you know, the various tour buses of people playing there. And I remember I saw Max Weinberg. I think it was during when Conan was there, actually. And I saw Max Weinberg getting into the bus. I'm like, Max! And he just looked at me and just turned around, didn't say anything, looked at me like with disgust, and then walked back up there.
When I was in college at Columbia College, I remember one time that a guy with a limo pulled up, and right outside somewhere, one of the clubs, and we're like, hey, can you give us a ride? You know, we're going this way. And he's like, yeah. And he was a Grateful Dead keyboard player, as we said he was. I don't know if that was the case. He's like, where are the girls? And I'm like, yeah, all right, man. I know where three girls living over here. And we got over there, and they weren't home. And he's like, you got to go. Like, and I just dropped me off. And I was like, well, I couldn't come through on that promise to the Grateful Dead keyboard player to the three friends from college that weren't home. All right, this is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago, WGNRadio.com. If you're an Amazon Echo user, just say play WGN Radio. Patty Vasquez up next here. We'll be back tomorrow night. We'll reload this week's news and continue another great show tomorrow night.